Everybody, welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, June 6, 2016. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern to midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-562-3140. Our participant code is 385-698. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. And please support our business partners. You can find the banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support National Liberty Alliance's effort to save America. Also, please, everyone, consider donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right and support our effort and work with us. Tonight's scripture reading is Proverbs chapter 19, verses 1 through 9. Better is the poor that walketh in his integrity than he that is perverse in his lips and is a fool. Also, that the soul be without knowledge, it is not good, and he that hasteth with his feet sinneth. The foolishness of man perverteth his way, and his heart fretteth against the Lord. Wealth maketh many friends, but the poor is separated from his neighbor. A false witness shall not be unpunished, and he that speaketh lies shall not escape. Many will entreat the favor of the prince, and every man is a friend to him that giveth gifts. All the brethren of the poor do hate him. How much more do his friends go far from him? He pursueth them with words, yet they are wanting to him. He that getteth wisdom loveth his own soul. He that keepeth understanding shall find good. A false witness shall not be unpunished, and he that speaketh lies shall perish. That was Proverbs chapter 19, verses 1 through 9. All right, I only got a couple of things to really talk about, and then we'll move over to Brent here. We'll also maybe take some questions. So, Gary, if you got any questions out there that need to be read, get them ready, and we'll try to answer them. But I'd like to really put the rest of rumor out there. You know, it's been circulating around, and people are making phone calls and trying to upset everyone. You know, the assault is upon National Liberty Alliance. And the assault right now, the big thing is they're claiming that with the writ of habeas corpus, that we're doing them improperly, that we should have gotten a number. And this was brought up last week, but it seems to still be lingering around. So we just want to address it and try to make it much more clearer, as clear as possible. I've told the individual that started this rumor that they didn't understand how things worked, and that you know, that the number is something that we use off the original case. You know, what people need to understand is a writ of habeas corpus is not opening a new case. It's concerning an existing case. It's generated from an existing case concerning due process. When an individual does not have the opportunity to face his accuser, to face the affidavit, the sworn statements against him that has put that individual in jail, when that person doesn't have that option to be able to face that and respond back to that, to rebut it, then he can file, or he or she can file for a habeas corpus. They petition the court for the habeas corpus. Now, I haven't heard of a habeas corpus going forward in years. All my time as far as being in the judicial process and working things, which is about 6 or 7 years now, I have not heard of anyone coming to a judge asking for a habeas corpus and the judge gives it to them. So the grand jury has decided that we're going to, the people will petition the grand jury for a habeas corpus. The grand jury will acknowledge that that petition and set forth the paperwork and send it to a federal judge. We send it to the chief federal judge to hear the case and deal with it appropriately. And we also let him know that we are going to do judicial oversight on this case. So we expect for him to do the right thing. But in every case, they default. And the law requires when a default happens, the person to be set free. Now, they haven't done that. Well, they have in a couple of cases, and it took them a long time, 30 days or more on a couple of cases we're aware of, where they did finally release the individual, and they didn't acknowledge they released them because of the habeas corpus, because they didn't want to acknowledge that. But generally speaking, most of them are not being released. But that's pressure on them. They're the ones breaking the law. And that certainly puts us into a position to make the point that due process is not being given to the people. The people want due process, and the judiciary is refusing them due process. That's the case. So they're making their own case. Now, the individual who is sending these rumors around and got people buzzing and stuff and talking about is claiming that we should go out and buy a number. First of all, why would a grand jury buy a number? That's the first thing. Anything, you know, when something is filed, the court should take it and apply a number accordingly. Every court applies their own number accordingly. You have a criminal case, which is generally the case where people are in prison, you know, so there's a criminal case. And also in the case of even the family courts where they've taken children away from people, there's a case number there. That's the case number. Now, because this is a due process concern, it's a violation of the Fifth Amendment, the right of the unalienable right of the individual to have due process protected by the Fifth Amendment, because it falls under the Constitution, it must go into the federal court. The federal court needs to hear the habeas corpus. So it's moved over for the hearing of the habeas corpus, decided on, and then everything goes back where the case is thrown out, it's dismissed. Well, federal judge doesn't do his job. And the state courts or whatever court it's generating from isn't doing their job. And so the best we could do is file the paperwork and continue. We go through the default process. We go through the contempt of court process. And now we just sit and wait for at this point. But it's pressure. We've got 28 cases. We got 18 cases that we're trying to work on. We're trying to work with someone to help us with the paperwork to get it printed up so we can get it out. So there's about 18 cases that are ready to go out, but they have to be put in form and sent out. So we're doing our best to meet that as soon as we can. So we're not going to give up on that. And then we'll see where we're at that point, reevaluate things, and we probably will pursue habeas corpuses, but we'll see where we go at the end of the 18 cases that we have to take care of. We're not going to take on any new cases until we get through those 18 cases. Okay, so there is already a number. And if the federal court wants to apply a number, that's their business. We've applied a number because we want to connect all of our cases, and we're opening up a common law court where all these other courts, are, generally speaking, are being opened up as an administrative type court or under the rules of chancery, and they're not operating under the rules of common law. So we file our paperwork and we give it a number. But we also have the number of the original case, and that's the important number. And if the federal court wants to put a number on it, of course they should put the number on it. After all, they have to be able to find their files on whatever case is, and any paper that comes in concerning that particular case has to be found by a number. That's how they keep all of the paperwork that's coming in with the case numbers. But certainly you wouldn't go out and buy one, because that's not the way it works. So this idea to go out, and also if you go buy one, and even if you had to buy one, which you don't have to buy one for a process of what's already going on in the courts, even if you had to buy one, from our perspective, it's dealing with the fiction, because the Supreme Court has ruled we will sell to no man. It's a common law fact that or principle or maxim, ultimately, that we shall sell to no man, ultimately. The bottom line is justice cannot be paid for. You cannot require a payment for justice. And even filing a paper in a court, the only thing necessary for a prima facie case is an affidavit from an injured party. That's it. There's nothing more. They don't need to have the ability to do anything else, although they have their forms and all these different things and so on. But nevertheless, that's the facts. So again, whoever's bringing these rumors up just trying to cause problems, they don't know what they're talking about. They don't know how the process works. I mean, certainly when a federal judge, you know, the only time they ever use habeas corpuses these days is when they move prisoners around. They have to use a habeas corpus. The judge will write up the paperwork for the habeas corpus to have a prisoner transferred. Okay, and certainly no new number is being put on that. The index number or the case number, whatever you want to call it, is already generated from the existing case, and that's the point. There is already a number. Okay, with that, we're going to move on. Let's see. I know Brent Winter is going to be talking about the militia, but before we go to Brent, Gary, do we have any questions out there?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Let me get to those. Okay. Okay, the first question is regarding the Magna Carta. And I think both you and Brent have mentioned the Magna Carta. And I'd like to read something that the question is about. It's saying, to get himself out of a snafu, King John conceded the whole of England and Ireland to the Pope perpetually in 1213. When the Magna Carta was established, it broke the terms of the concession and forfeited all authority to the papacy. King John then claimed to annul the Magna Carta, and on August 24, 2015, so did Pope Innocent III in a papal bull. In 1216, after King John's passing, the Magna Carta was claimed to have been reenacted, but unless it was by the Pope, the only one with any recognized valid authority, it doesn't seem to matter. Has the Magna Carta and the common law on which it's based just been a public fraud all this time, supported by the people but lacking any official authority behind it? That's the question.
Wow, what a question. Okay, yeah. I might comment on that in a minute or two, but I know Brent is here, and this is his specialty, and his book has really dealt a lot with, of course, the Magna Carta. It's about the common law. Brent, do you want to try to field that question?
Well, yes, if I may, and I appreciate it, and appreciate the question, and it's an important subject, important for now, very much for now, to understand what happened. But I want to preface it with this. When I talk about Magna Carta, I don't say the Magna Carta, and the reason I don't do that, even though Americans have always taken particular delight in mispronouncing Latin words, and I support that idea, because I don't think anybody knows how they were pronounced anyway, but Magna Carta never had a definite article in front of it, never had the, because Latin doesn't have a definite article, and the man who wrote Magna Carta, Stephen Langton, and I like to always add, he's the man that gave us the chapter divisions of our Bibles. The man that drafted it, he was the chief draftsman. He wrote it in Latin. And it's, for me, I just say Magna Carta because it saves space when I write it. I don't say thee, and I think that's acceptable. But Magna Carta, the things that were said here about the papacy are in the main true. John had turned the whole country of England, along with all the profits and lands, and of course burdened all the landholders of England with taxation from Rome, and Rome then was owned everything, and as it was said in those days, England became a fief. That's F-E-I-F, or some people say F-I-E-F, but that means it becomes a cash cow for Rome, for the power, the foreign power of Rome. That's true, that really happened. But that's only a third of it. The other third of it, or the other two-thirds of it, is this. He'd also promised the entire country of England would become Islamic. He promised that to the Sultan of Morocco, who was Islamic, and the Sultan of Morocco said, I'll give you, John, he was king, King John, I'll give you all the gold and silver you want to mount war against the landholders of England and get them back in their place, but you have to promise me you'll make all of England by official proclamation Islamic. He did that at the same time. But then that's only two-thirds of it. The other third of it was this. He had indebted the entire country, and that means, of course, the landholders, because the debt was on them to pay the debt as taxpayers. He had indebted the entire country to the moneylenders of England, and they're referenced in Magna Carta, the Jewish moneylenders, and the Jewish people in England were the only ones, by law at that time, allowed to lend money to anybody in England, because usury, according to the Bible and according to the common law, was against the law, as it still is and should be. But they were given special dispensation to loan money to Englishmen for two reasons. Number one, they figured them not being Christian, they were going to hell anyway, so they'd let them do it. And besides that, they thought, we need the money. Well, that's bad enough, but King John had indulged himself in the interest rates annually for loans to the money lenders in England were from 42 to 83% per year. 42 to 83% per year. So John had burdened all the landholders of England, and that included every person, because every person was connected to the land, and that was that's a fascinating set of ties there that drew people together. But every person was indebted to the moneylenders of England, the Islamic Sultan of Morocco, he had promised to make all England Islamic, and the Pope of Rome became, at John's official turning over the country to him, the Emperor of England. The situation was on the very verge of bloody, slaughtering war. And the barons, the landholders, as we call them now, had made full preparation of war, had fielded an army bigger than John's, and John had a big army too, and the Pope had commissioned the invasion of England by Frenchmen, the French army, and the landholders of England were in a dire set of straits to defend their holdings against everybody. And all of the evils of the evil empire were crashing in on them, just as today the law that threatens us is Islamic law, Roman law, and Pharisaical law. All three have always threatened the United States and do threaten today in a way bigger than ever before. And Europe is falling to that. And if we do not, but let me get back to the question. I'm getting admonitional here. But the question was, has Magna Carta always been not really in effect as a matter of official proclamation? And the truth is, yes. Yes, in other words, to put it in the negative, no, it hasn't been in effect by official proclamation in England. And England kept reaching back and trying to reestablish it, and it created more bloodshed. And by the time Englishmen and British people, I should say really, British people, including Scotsmen, Germanic people, and then the Scotch-Irish and the Irish people and the English-speaking people, including the Dutch, of course, in New York, by the time, and others that were less numerous, by the time they got to America, they were having the same problem. They saw that Magna Carta, its first principles, which were the first principles of our common law, were not being practiced in England the way they thought they should be. Indeed, they weren't much. And so they said, we'll come to the New World and we'll establish those principles here. And then Britain's empire said, no, you're not going to do that. And as I'd said before, the King of England became emperor in the colonies, but king in England. And so the common law didn't apply, as Blackstone said. So the colonists in America went to war to establish the principles of, that Magna Carta had recorded, those observations of the nature of the way things are, and we cannot change. Magna Carta is an agreement, most fundamentally, between the Crown of England and the landholders as to what is right and what is wrong, what is the law as it had to be applied to them in their own day. But the principles of Magna Carta throughout have not changed, will not change, and are incorporated in our United States Constitution, even lifting its most fundamental language from the Magna Carta, the phrase law of the land included in our Article 6 of our Constitution, that this Constitution shall be the supreme law of the land, and that phrase, law of the land, is a phrase denoting common law due process, and our common law doesn't contain due process. I like to say and say often, our common law is due process. And the thing that distinguishes us and the Bible is the same way. It's a matter of process. That's why the Bible talks about the way, the path, the course of our common law. That's the phrase that we use in our Northwest Ordinance of 1787 talks about the course of the common law. Our Constitution uses the term course of the common law because our common law is process, and there are many ways to say it, but when Magna Carta was drafted, the phrase common law had not yet come into use in England. It did not too many centuries after. English became the official language of Parliament during the 1300s, and the phrase common law then began to pick up steam. But before that, it was called law of the land or land law. And the law that's connected to the land became the important thing. And the land, by the way, is important because the land is the most important thing because the Bible makes the land the most important thing. And that's why our common law is called land law or law of the land. But it wasn't official. It wasn't official. That's right. That's true. But never forget that our common law is the binding law upon all men at all times. Because it is, as Justice James Wilson of the U.S. Supreme Court put it, it is of origin divine. It's God's law. How do I know? Well, because it's what we observe in the nature of creation, in the nature of things. God made creation a certain way. It isn't going to change. We can't change the laws of nature or the laws of nature's God, written or unwritten in creation or written in the Bible. And these principles because they don't change, we call them law. That law, that's what law means. Law, the old Danish word, that which cannot change, will not move for anybody, and its consequences, the creator, the lawgiver, will not alter under any circumstances for anybody. And that is why, of course, well, there's a lot more to that. I guess that's enough talk about it. But that's the story of the common law. And again, I stress, the common law is enforced. It is impossible that the common law cannot be enforced. It is the law of nature. But I want to drop one footnote. That is not the natural law. The law of nature is not the natural law of St. Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas, Thomism, the official doctrine of Islam, by the way, although they call it by a different name, of Romanism, by the way, although they call it Thomism after St. Thomas Aquinas, and the law of Phariseeism. All three of those arose in their modern form at the same time from three men who were fully aware of one another and used the same methods and copied one another. They're just different names, different labels. The evil empire is good at changing labels, changing names, and offering the same thing up over and over and over again with a little bit different color. Magna Carta is a great stepping stone down through history of our common law, a solid one. And our Constitution is another one, solid one. The English Declaration of Rights, which fell between those two of the 1600s, was another one. The laws of King Alfred before Magna Carta, there's another one. I'm not putting them in order. They're coming to mind. But these writings of our expressions recording our common law understanding are the great stepping stones of that observable, unwritten law found in the nature of things. I hope I hit the nail on the head, John. If I didn't, maybe somebody can correct me.
Okay, I appreciate it. I think that was very well put. Okay, Gary, any other questions? Thank you, Brent.
Yes, I have another question, but I'd like to make a clarification in this email question first. This is from Jim. Jim, your transcriptions are highly appreciated, and they have been posted since 2015 on the NLA page. If you go to the main page and click the Monday Night Call and arrow all the way to the bottom, you will find all of your God-given, wonderfully appreciated transcriptions. So just so you know, they did not go unnoticed. But Jim had a question, and if the NLA is not going to be doing habeas corpus, he has a brother-in-law who's in deep trouble with many constitutional violations. Should he do a habeas corpus for himself? I mean, should he do the habeas corpus himself for his brother-in-law? What should he do?
Yeah, look, you could try that. I've done a habeas corpus personally for an individual down in New York City before we even started doing habeas corpuses here, and we didn't do it using the grand jury. But I used the procedure, really, that Bill Thornton had put out and really just pushing it through the courts, as a next friend and bypassing the judge. But of course, putting it into the judge's hand with the order to hear the case and to expose of it judicially, and it took 30 days. We did a default; they defaulted, and we put the default in, and within 30 days, they released the individual from prison with no reasoning. Okay, and I believe, of course, it was because of the habeas corpus, so it did work. Since then, of course, we've done it through the grand jury, and we've got two people that were released from jail, which after we had done a habeas corpus. We've done 28 habeas corpuses through the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury. 26 of them have not been released, but we're doing our best we can to do the pressure on these judges and on the all of the parties involved that are now illegally holding these people. So you can try it, but I don't want to say we're not doing these anymore because, look, this is the most important thing we can do. First of all, it makes the case. If we have to a point where we have 100 habeas corpuses and 98 of them or 90 of them are just ignored, that just makes our case, doesn't it? And that's a very powerful case. So for that purpose alone, the pressure of doing the habeas corpus and putting it out there, and eventually, When we have certain cases coming up, we're hoping to really get some traction through the media at some point. And when that breaks, then, of course, they'll get the pressure and the stories about the habeas corpuses. Mm-hmm. At some point, something's got to give. Remember, they've got a wall of resistance up, and we have to put the pressure on it. And how's the best way to put the pressure? Just tell the truth and lay it in the court. And we just don't lay it in one court. We lay it in all 94 federal district courts. So they can't say they didn't receive it. They can't hide from it. That's all pressure. That's all stress. And so we're putting stress and pressure onto that process. So I think we have one or two more people we need to talk with to try to have the habeas corpus going forward again. We might have some success, hopefully, this week with that. And if we do, then we're going to move back in and get the 18 or so habeas corpuses that are really in the queue to go forward. I haven't checked through them to make sure that they're all ready to go, but I've been told by Linda that they were ready to go. So hopefully we have 18 to push forward and get that done, and then we'll decide where we go from there. And I'm sure we're going to continue with the habeas corpus because I think that they're so important. So anyway, that's pretty much the answer to that question. Was there a second part to that? Oh, so if they want to wait, for a little while until we can catch up with this, they can try it on their own. But unless you really, I guess I did had the right thing with the right pressure. And they did know, by the way, the people who were down in New York City, we're talking about the judges, they knew who I was, because they had dealt with me through National Liberty Alliance. But I didn't do it in the name of the grand jury, nor did I bring up National Liberty Alliance. So that might have had something to do also with the pressure of them doing something. And we had already went after, I think it was eight of the administrative judges here in New York State that are responsible for all of the administrations of the judicial process of New York State. These are the people that are supposed to be making sure that things are being done properly, judicially. People are getting due process. That was their job, and they were not doing it, and that's why we went after them. And so maybe that's another reason why it went through down there. I don't know. It's just guesses. But again, it is much more powerful to have it done through the grand jury. That puts more weight on things, I think, in my opinion. And it builds up the pressure with a bunch of other habeas corpuses that are in place. So it's up to you whether you want to try to wait until we catch up, or if you want to go forward on your own. And, Bill Thornton, like I said, puts a lot of information. I rewrote a lot of the stuff that he had suggested and put it in what I think was a much better perspective. So anyway, that's the best I can offer on that. Gary, anything else?
Yeah, the last question, and this is going to be more, I think, more history, so I hope either you or Brent can answer it. The question goes exactly the way I'm going to read it. When Justice Taney said that the local militia has the authority to enforce writs of habeas corpus against U.S. Army regulars, was Justice Taney referring to a standing army or to an army specifically raised for the war between the states? Specifically, when did America begin having a standing army?
Well, Brent, do you feel that you can answer that question?
I'll respond to it. Maybe I can shed some light, and I found some things that may be of use in answering the question. But okay. I know, for instance, as far back as what they called Madison's War, the War of 1812, the militia of the states were instrumental in fighting that war. But going back to the Revolution, of course, George Washington wanted an army that took an oath to the United States. He didn't want to form up militias from the colonies. He saw that ultimately there was a problem. What I'm saying is he wanted a standing army for the duration of the war. He saw that as important because, well, he'd had negative experiences otherwise. And that's essentially what happened. Of course, the Constitution, as our Constitution, as the question alludes to this point, is that standing armies are not permitted except for a certain period of time to be funded as such. And the standing army, of course, the militias, by the time we got the War of 1812, then by the time we got to the war between the northern and the southern tiers of states, the militia were the militias were still important there, and Lincoln put out the call for each of the states to produce X number of men according to their populations to come and protect initially Washington, D.C. And the states responded, but things began to get really blurry between what we would call today the militia of the several states, what I call the militia of the several states because that's the language of our United States Constitution. The blurry line began between them and Army regulars. And our Congress at that point, everything changed. And as I had mentioned once before, during that war, our Constitution was flipped upside down on its head up during and after that war. There were 6,000 federal employees approximately at the beginning of the war. At the end of the war, there were approximately 60,000 federal employees, and the number of federal employees had grown exponentially ever since. And the whole blurring between the militia of the several states and the Army and then the National Guard after the turn of the 19th century came in. However, units were raised during World War I, during the Spanish-American War, units were raised locally, but the idea of the militias of the states became blurred again, and we all have heard of the Rough Riders, for example. Teddy Roosevelt raised them from throughout the country. Who knows? There were probably a lot of outlaws in that outfit, people trying to recuperate themselves from former lifestyles. That's what I've read about some of them. I, of course, don't know who some of them. But the point of that is, it didn't amount to militia of the several states. And then the Rainbow Division of World War I was formed, and the idea was it would defy, the Rainbow Division would defy the militia of the several states. Oddly, they named it the Rainbow, I should say curiously, the Rainbow Division. And they were taken from throughout the United States for the first time. Men fought alongside each other from throughout the country in a way they had never done before. Maybe that wasn't such a good idea. Of course, by the time World War II came along, the idea of a standing regular army was in place, and the Cold War after World War II became the reason to keep the standing army and keep it in place because we were at war without having declared war, or so it was said, and many of us remember that in spades, what it was like. And the draft, of course, was very much a part of that from after World War II right on through the 1970s through the Vietnam conflict. Can't call it a war because it was never declared. We never had an official enemy in that war. Didn't even know who the enemy was exactly. That's when you start having enemies that have labels such as communism and terrorism, all these isms and schisms that we wish was wasms. All of those became, and when you do that, when isms become the war, then no longer do you have enemies with bodies that you can fight, and no longer are you out to conquer territory. And if you're not out to conquer territory, of course, the war is nothing but a water hole and a waste of human life. I have that on good authority, by the way. People much more educated on the subject than myself. But the militia just continually, starting with the war between the northern and southern tiers of the states, became increasingly, intensively blurred with the standing army. And what we do now with the standing army is unconstitutional. There's no question about that. And Congress is authorized to fund the army, standing army, only for a certain period of time. But then again, that's not really possible anymore the way things are now with the money system, because Congress has no power of the purse. If the government wants money, they just print more and sell it according to the cost of printing to the Federal Reserve Bank, and then they give it back to them. Congress has no part in it, really. So that doesn't really matter as a practical matter. As a lawful matter, it does. But we've violated the Constitution by slow creep. We've allowed it. And that's why it's important to say, no, the law says this. The government doesn't have power to do whatever it is it wants to do, and point out that the Constitution has not granted that power. The states and the people of the United States have not granted this power or that power to the Constitution. And the key to this, Ron Paul made much of this, wrote a little book on it called In the Fed. The key to all of this is to stop the monopoly of issuing money that now exists. That's an unlawful monopoly, as all monopolies are unlawful. As Justice Coke said, they're against the common law and against the liberty of the individual, and a monopoly cannot exist without government force and violence. It can't do it. And so it is something that people don't want. It abuses people, and the issuance of money out of that arises a lot of our problem. We see it now even with this whole bathroom thing, with the showering of men, boys, and girls together. That's a money problem. The states don't make their own money. They've forgotten they even can authorize money in legal tender and gold and silver in most cases. So they're dependent upon the Federal Reserve Bank for the issuance of money. And Congress comes along, or Congress, the government, or the president, whoever's sitting in the White House, I shouldn't call him president, but he comes along and says, if you don't do this, that, and the t'other, like I tell you, you're not getting any money. Well, the states have forgotten that they have the ability to deal in money that way and to authorize gold and silver, which is what our Constitution says. But the standing army problem is all connected to the blurring of the distinctions between the standing army, or the federal armed forces, the national armed forces, and the militia of the several states.
Okay, thank you, Brent. All right, anything else out there, Gary?
No, that's it.
Okay. All right, thanks a lot, Brent. Appreciate that. All right, as a matter of fact, we're going to move over to Brent now. Brent Winters, author of The Common Law, The Excellence in Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. And Brent's going to continue to talk tonight, I believe, on the militia, which I think this is part five. I don't remember, but it'll be tagged accordingly once we put it up. But anyway, Brent, you got the mic. Go right ahead.
Thanks, John. And again, thank you for inviting me to do this. I relish the opportunity to talk about what I think is important, and I don't want my life to end. Not that it's going to anytime soon, I hope, but I wouldn't want it to be over and me not look back and say I did what I could do and took the opportunities I could to promote the right idea for the sake of my own family and the families of others. But we want to do that. And the only remedy for the lawlessness we see is law. There is no other remedy. The only remedy for lawlessness, and that's what we're seeing, is law. And that means true law, the right law, the only law from the true lawgiver. And our militia of the several states, as our Constitution puts it, the militia of the several states, it's four clauses of our Constitution. No people on the history of our planet, or the history of Adam's race, have ever had such a clear, forthright, written law concerning the militia of their own country, as have Americans since the Israelites of old, as it is set forth most prominently in the book called Numbers. The book called Numbers in the Bible, the fourth book of the Bible, is a book about martial law, which is really the law of the city, but it's a book about its right jurisdiction. We, our common law, is the law of the land. The law of the city is martial law at heart. Most recently in modern times, it is the law of the Roman legions taken to govern cities and then countries and then empires. The law of the city is a martial law, but it has a proper use. And that proper use is to apply it to armed forces in the field and to sailors on ships at sea. And if it's confined to those two things, primarily and foremost, it has a good use. But to apply it to people that are not members of the armed forces, destroy and ships at sea, admiralty law, that's the other label it uses, is to destroy our freedoms. When the militia of the several states is called, any of the persons of it, is called into actual duty, whether by the governor of the state of that militia, or by the president of the United States in the national service, for whatever reason, for the three reasons given, unless and until a militiaman is called into that duty, mustered, and that's the key word, mustered under our common law. I'm repeating here what Justice Joseph Story says in his commentaries. When that happens, once mustering occurs, the martial law applies to that man. He's no longer entitled to trial by jury. Why? Because he's entitled to the court's martial in the case of accusation of a crime while he is a militia, while he's serving under arms mustered as a militiaman. Well, let's really quick review the four clauses. We're in the second one. That's where we left off last time. But just quickly, the first militia clause of our Constitution charges the Congress of the United States with providing rules for the separate states for calling forth the militia when called into the service of the United States, and only can be done so for three reasons. I'm quoting our Constitution here: to execute the laws of the Union, to suppress insurrections and repel invasions, and finally and thirdly, for governing such part of them. No, I had that wrong. Finally and thirdly, for enforcing the laws of the United States, and then the reason for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. Congress has the power to set forth those rules, but that's the only power it has. It does not have the power of applying or enforcing them. That's the first militia clause, concerns Congress. The second militia clause of our Constitution reserves to the states, respectively, each one of them alone, the appointment of officers of the militia of that state and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress in the first militia clause. It talks about that. The appointment of officers, the federal government, cannot do that according to our Constitution. Must that power, and that's a lot of power. And that's control, too, by the way, appoints its own officers. Accordingly, each state has the common law responsibility to provide practical standards for its militia. What kind of firearm and the amount of ammunition each member must provide himself and safely keep. The level of training, discipline, and the skill he must himself attain. The state legislator has the state legislature has the responsibility to set those standards. So the first militia clause concerns Congress. The second militia clause concerns the states, respectively. The third militia clause of our Constitution gives the President of the United States authority over any member of a state militia only when called into actual service of the United States. And that means, according to our common law informs our Constitution, that means not before they're mustered, but when a fellow is mustered and he says present and he's standing in ranks, then the President has authority over him according to the law of the militia law, the martial law that Congress has provided today. That would probably be the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That's the third militia clause, concerns the President. The fourth militia clause concerns the people of the United States, the militia. The people means the militia. That's the old common law term taken, by the way, from the Old Testament. And if you go to the Old Testament, every time you see that phrase, the people, translating the Hebrew phrase, ha'am, ha'am, the people, it refers to an armed band of men. Now, sometimes, in most cases, it refers to the militia of Israel. But sometimes it's also used to refer to the armed forces of another people, too. But the people means, it came to mean, the militia. And it's a phrase that occurs in our Constitution. It's an important phrase. The fourth militia clause is different than the preceding three in this way. The first three militia clauses grant authority to three classes of people that they did not before at that time have. Those three classes are Congress, state governors and legislators, the President. All three of those groups, those classes of people, these militia clauses, grant authority, give authority. The fourth militia clause, which we call the Second Amendment, grants nothing. It acknowledges a fundamental right. A fundamental right is a right given direct to the individual from the Creator. That's what a fundamental right is. You know, we talk about rights, and then we talk about fundamental rights in law. That is ultimately the meaning of a fundamental right. And it is a fundamental right that a man has a duty. That's what a right is. It's a duty to do something, to make a decision, to act. It's a duty to self-protection, protection of one's family and one's people, one's land, is country. And that's what the Fourth Militia Clause, called the Second Amendment, does. It just recognizes and affirms, guarantees that the government will not allow the infringement of a man's right to keep and bear, that means carry, a loaded firearm, a gun. That's what the Second Amendment means, because without the Second Amendment, the powers granted to Congress, to the state governors and state legislators, to the president, those powers our Constitution grants to those three classes of people, would be meaningless if men didn't have the right that were, the men are the militia of the several states, if they didn't have the right, and as I said, the right is a duty, an affirmative duty, to keep and carry a loaded weapon. That's the meaning of the Second Amendment as our law informs it, as our common law informs it. Here's this quote I often quote, and I forget the fellow's name that says this. His name, I've got it here, footnoted. It says his name is Neil Smith, so I'll drop this footnote. I'm quoting him. The only reason anybody has for taking your gun away, says Neil Smith, is to make you weaker than he is, so he can do something to you that you would not allow him to do if you were equipped to prevent it. The only reason, I'll repeat it, the only reason anybody has for taking your gun away is to make you weaker than he is, so he can do something to you that you would not allow him to do if you were equipped to prevent it. That should be repeated often. As a matter of history, and history, if it's the right history, it's fact. That's true. That is utterly true. Because to take a people's individual right to own a weapon, to hamper it, to hinder it, you can't take the right away. That's not possible. If the right's given from God, it is a duty given from God. It is non-delegable, and it can't be removed, as their Declaration of 76 says. These are inalienable. Fundamental rights are inalienable. Fancy word just means it's impossible for a man to separate himself from them. How can a man take, and a right is a duty, and that's what that old Germanic Anglo-Saxon word means. It means duty. They have another word in law, an ancient word, and it's still used in the Germanic languages today that refers to what we call what I want and what's selfish. The word right has been hackneyed till it sounds selfish. It's not. It denotes a duty, a responsibility. If God gives you a responsibility individually, and he has lots of them, we call them fundamental rights, right to speak or not to speak, etc., the right to choose your association with the God of your choice, your understanding of him, or with other people. If God has given you that duty to make those decisions, and he has, by the way, directly, how could you possibly delegate that responsibility to somebody else unless he gives you permission, and he hasn't? And even if you tried it, it wouldn't work. And the men that drafted our Constitution, those fellows, those framers, said that often. They said it in many different ways, and it was just an observation that they make. It's in the Bible. Every man's responsible for his own actions and for what God tells him to do. And no man, by the way, no man has the right. The right? Yeah, the duty, the responsibility. No man has the right to do wrong. In other words, he doesn't have the right to disown the duties that God has given him. My father used to give me duties when I was within his control, and I didn't have the option of giving them to somebody else. And he wouldn't allow it. It was impossible. And my father told me and taught me that he didn't even have the right to forget his duties as a father and give them to somebody else. Why? Well, God gave them to him. I even told my children the same way, the same thing. I can't give my duties away. In times of frustration and in times of discouragement, and I'd want to just throw it all to the wind and go be by myself and not have any responsibilities. Well, that's not possible. Once your father or husband, you got a duty, and it is a right, and it's nobody else's, and nobody else can take your place. You're stuck with it. It's not such a bad thing. It's a good thing, but when discouragement comes, you may say, I'd like to do that, but you can't. It is impossible. That's the point of the Declaration of 76 when it says your rights, your responsibilities are inalienable. What an incredible privilege from God. From God is a privilege. But as to men, it's a fundamental right. They can't touch it. God grants it. And as to God, it's a privilege that we have to be able to have these responsibilities and to live them out and to fill them. It's the only fulfilling thing that man has, is to fulfill his responsibilities before God. It is the chief end of man. And if you aren't going outside of yourself, there will be no satisfaction in the end. Your duty is to your Maker. And without that, you won't have the power to have any significance. If you're the only significance you have, that doesn't amount to much. That's why America has ended up being such a powerful engine. Well, simply put, Amendment 2, that's the Second Amendment, bars the national government or any state government from interfering with any one of the people's non-delegable right and duty to keep and bear arms. Indeed, if our Second Amendment stands for anything, it stands for this. Listen to this closely, and if you would, hear me well. It stands for this: security and freedom at the same time are possible only as each militiaman of each state fulfills his duty in accord with our Constitution's four militia clauses. Without the Second Amendment, the filling of it, people picking up their duty there, the other three amendments don't, the other three militia clauses, I should say, don't matter. It would be a water hole. In the event Congress neglects our Constitution's mandate to provide rules for training the militia of the several states, as indeed Congress has neglected, our Constitution requires each state to organize, arm, discipline, and train its own militia. In the event both Congress and the several states neglect our Constitution's mandates to them, then the people, that is the militia, must never neglect their constitutionally required right to keep themselves forearmed and skilled in the use of arms. To be sure, if the people fail to fulfill this fundamental duty, the national government will gain an absolute monopoly of violent force and power. Let me repeat that one. If the people of the United States fail to fulfill this fundamental duty of the Second Amendment, the national government will gain an absolute monopoly of violent force and power, and will evermore both dominate the states and oppress the people, as is now seen. It's inevitable. Government, as Washington observed so well, is nothing but force. When the government wants something, it can't do anything but use force or threat of force. That's the only tool it has. And if that doesn't work, then that being the only tool they have, it has, it just cranks up the force and threat of force to a greater degree. And that continues. Force and threat of force. Force and threat of force. In all events, our Constitution assigns none of these tasks of the four militia clauses to any Army, Navy, National Guard, constitutionally unknown, that's what the National Guard is, doesn't assign to any of them, and least of all to any police force or any bureaucratic agency. Our Constitution does none of those things. Who has the monopoly of force and violence in the United States today? The Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, the National Guard, the police forces, and the bureaucratic agents. Increasingly, they all carry weapons more all the time. The readiness, however, of the militia of the several states, supreme law. The readiness of the militia of the several states is the supreme law of the land. It all ties together, our Constitution does. It's like a seamless, interwoven, warp-and-woof garment. And to tear in of it is to weaken all of it. And this readiness, if it does not remain so, of the militia of the several states, the criminal law industry's police state thugs will further swell into the void, as is now seen also. Americans continue to ignore our common law first principles of our Constitution's militia clauses at great peril to their freedom. The state militias, being the people themselves, are no creation of our Constitution. Rather, our Constitution recognizes their existence. In fact, because the militia is, as also is the jury, a part of the people. Neither government nor even the people can end the militia nor alter its fundamental right, that is, its duty. In fact, both the militia and the jury are subsets of the people, those very persons establishing and ordaining our Constitution. Well, that's enough for this evening, I think. John, I appreciate it again, and I'm hanging on if anybody wants to throw questions at me.
All right, thank you, Brent. Yeah, we'll take a few questions if anybody's got any questions. Let me open up the queue here for questions. All right, anybody that's got a question or a comment for Brent here, star 6 to get into the queue. Star 6, any questions or comments for Brent? Okay, we'll take our first caller here. Robert from Illinois, you got the mic. Go right ahead. Robert, can you hear us? Let me try unmuting you again. Oh, there you go. Go ahead, Robert. Robert from Illinois, you've been unmuted. Let me try again. Sometimes there's a delay here, so let me try again. Robert, try to talk right now. Robert?
Hello?
Yep, you got it. Go right ahead, Robert.
Okay, yeah. I was just going to ask, this is something that's come up before. I know there are two different Magna Cartas. As I understand, there's the 1512, and then there's 1525. Is that correct?
Bro, you're close. At 1215 and 1225, you just had
I'm
the
I'm sorry,
numbers.
Yeah, I had, yeah, that's I had what the other one. 1215 and 1225.
I knew what you meant. Yeah.
And, what's the main difference? And do we really need to know that? Is that really significant?
No, it's not significant. In my humble opinion, there are some differences, and they were changes that occurred. And as I remember it, and again, I referred to I've got 40 hours of lectures on concerning Magna Carta, blow by blow and clause by clause, and I try to go through. And when those differences come up in the text, I try to cite them and explain what happened. It was reissued in 1225. I think you've got that number right. And the reissuance, again, I think, then Edward I in the 1300s, and contrary to Hollywood's opinion of him in the movie William Wallace, he was a pretty good fellow. As a matter of fact, King Edward I, he had a drooping eye on one side and stuttered, and he was a dark-headed fellow, had shoulder-length hair, self-conscious of his physical imperfections. But for whatever else he was a champion of our common law, and he did much to establish it in his own country. His policies were in tune with our common law and in tune with Magna Carta probably more than hardly any other after him, or before him, before him from the Norman invasion forward. Henry II also did a lot to establish the permanency of our common law in the face of the Norman priest that came in with William. But it was established, the English people, the people of England, often demanded that people filling that executive power of king reaffirm Magna Carta. And they'd give it lip service or they'd reissue it, but sometimes then they'd use that as an opportunity, I'll reissue it, but they'd leave something out, see, that bothered them, that they thought went against them in a way they didn't like. So fundamentally, it's not something to concern a fellow to concern himself with. What I'd say to people is, I'd point out that Magna Carta's anniversary of 800 years was last year. It's a good time to start and reacquaint ourselves with its principles. Just go back to the first one. Stephen Langton drafted it. It was his pen. It was thrown together. It's rather haphazard in many ways because it was thrown together in the heat of impending, all-out, vicious war. And Langton wanted to do all he could to subvert it, and by golly, he got it done. he got it done. He was the great broker that brought the two parties together. And, of course, the barons, or the baron, the landholders, had the drop on him. They had the upper hand, and they had their swords at his throat. And they said, sign or die, or fight. And I suppose he probably would have got whooped. They were serious, and they had motivation behind them against him. And he wasn't in the right. He didn't have the high ground, and he gave up and signed. And we have Magna Carta as an agreement. But just concentrate on the first one, the one that Langton drafted. And then as you go through it, you'll discover later, and if you read about it and you find a good commentary, there are many out there that just describe the history of the times. It'll bring up where the differences are and what they are. But no, again, to answer the question directly, I don't think it's of great import that we focus on the differences as much as we just read it and try to understand the fundamentals. It is the unwrought rudiments that were missing, the first principles, the basic fundamental principles that we're not grabbing. Trial by jury. Parse that part of Magna Carta. Try to understand it. Read Lysander Spooner's parsing of trial by jury according to Magna Carta. I don't suppose anybody has ever broke it down as much as him. Now, Sir Edward Coke did an excellent job in his commentaries on Magna Carta, and our founders, our framers, those, our forefathers, our forebears, relied more on Sir Edward Coke's writings than any other person. And his writings primarily were his commentaries on Magna Carta.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're
okay,
welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question.
Thank you, Robert. Okay, we'll take our next caller is Terry from Colorado.
Hi, this is Terry from Colorado. I got to with page 318, section 3.8.1 about the divine right of kings, and that the very last paragraph is really interesting. I just want to read part of it, if I may.
Well, sure. I want to hear it.
In the civil law tradition, rulers rule instead of God through the use of civil laws. Through the use of civil laws, inquisitional system, these rulers labored to induce fear as a stabilizing ingredient of their rule. Thus the civil law plays out its principles to their logical conclusions. In other words, their self-deification. In the many anarchists have defined anarchy as rules but no rulers. I wanted to get your take, considering that the rulers rule instead of God, that their deification or semi-deification helps explain the enormities of the Roman emperors. I'm quoting you again. And how does that fit into that definition of anarchy, or do you have a different one?
Oh, I'm a word man. I attach the greatest importance to words, and the reason I do that, because somebody much more famous and learned than I said, don't remember his name either, but he said, where men lose the meanings of words, they lose their lives, their liberties, and property. I found that to be true, reading history anyway. And I see it today. I was talking to somebody today and failed to distinguish between asking forgiveness and confessing wrong. Well, what's the difference, they said. I said, well, a lot of difference. Well, it goes true with the word anarchy. What is anarchy? Well, let's just go to the word. Let's start with that, because that's a word that's frozen in time. It's an ancient language. The A-N on the front is the negating particle. And the N is attached to it. It's called the alpha privative in the ancient world. Alpha is the letter A primarily. But the N is added to distinguish it from what follows because the sounds are soft. But anarchy means no ruler or no rule. It's just people running amok. Mobs running places and robbing and looting. And we've seen it in microcosm and in riots and things like that. That's anarchy. That's what I take anarchy to be. But when a country or a people is ruled by the principles of the law of the city, we can also call it the law of Babylon, the city of Babylon, those principles have come through. And I stress also again that almost every country in the world is under some form of the Code of Justinian, the Code of the Roman Empire. In one of its three forms, either the German form, the Code Napoleon, it's called, the German form, the Code of Bismarck, it's called, the French form, the Code Napoleon, it's called, or the Canon Law of Rome. Those three are the three forms. They're fundamentally alike, and universities throughout the world since the forming of the university system, which is Rome's system, beginning in Bologna, Italy, throughout the world have always offered their final degree in what they call the civil and canon law. Civil means city. Canon refers to the church. That means the Roman law of church and state. It's a dual degree offered throughout the world. Universities in South America, of course, they're all Roman law countries too. Well, all of those things speak of rulers. And the sima deification, I like to call it sima deification. I'm following a lot of comparative lawyers that say that because, for example, and I like to use this. This is a great example in modern times. In Japan, the emperor there, Japan, had taken on the Code of Bismarck, the Code of Germany, which was the Code of Justinian tweaked about the year 1900. Japan took it on, and then it was possible in their culture, so they did. It wasn't semi-deification. They just flat said, this man, this emperor of Japan, he is our God, and we are sons of the sun. We are sons of the sun, and the rising sun was on the flag, and he is God, and they all worshiped him, just as they worship, by the way, the emperor in North Korea today. The only public worship in North Korea that's permitted is worship of that puny man, whatever his name is. It's ridiculous, but that's what happens. Well, that's what happened there. Well, in Germany, they had the same thing. But they knew they couldn't get away with it because it was fundamentally a Christian nation. They couldn't get away with calling him God, so the comparative lawyers through the years have called such deification, a semi-deification. You give him all the powers of a god, let him make himself think he has those powers, but don't call him a god. But that's what he is. He's a lawgiver. There is no appeal from his orders. That's what a lawgiver is anciently, an El or an Elohim in the old Semitic speech. That is a person or a combination of persons who has final authority to decide between right and wrong in any given specific instance from whom there is no appeal. That's a god. That's a lawgiver. And that's what Hitler was, as was Mussolini. Now, these semi-deified lawgivers, these mere puny men who claim the powers of God and people are dumb enough to afford those powers to them as useful idiots, they're useful idiots, such men do bring some order. It's a bad order, but it's not an order of freedom, but it is an order. And as they said of Mussolini, he did make the trains run on time. Order came pretty quick, but it came at a horrible, horrible price. There is some order under men that claim the powers of God. Now, the other thing that happens in this semi-deification we see in modern forms in religion, the priesthood, as Thomas Jefferson would put it. Men say, well, I'm not God. I'm just standing in place of God. I have been given the authority of God and the case of the church, there's a man that says he's been given all of the authority of Jesus Christ on earth. That's hogwash. It needs to be said, utter, absolute hogwash. It's a lie. Well, if a man has all the power of Jesus Christ on earth, what he's saying is, I have all the power of God. Well, he doesn't. But he's getting as much as he can, always has, grappled for as much as he could get. But claimed it all, by the way. Power to raise armies, tax all people. His name only is to be spoken. That's the official doctrine. That happens in small ways and large ways throughout the world constantly. And by the way, vicar of Christ, that's the Latin way of saying it. The Greek words, the Greek equivalent to vicar of Christ is antichristos. It's in the New Testament four times. Vicar of Christ means antichristos, and antichristos means vicar of Christ. And those two phrases, most literally by the letters, mean in the place of Christ. Well, to the Christian man, that means in the place of God, because Christ is God reduced to the span of a man by the virgin birth through Mary. So Vicar of Christ, so the simidification, and that's what the comparative lawyers, Merriman of Bolt Hall and Berkeley, and William Franklin Fratcher of University of Missouri, two leading men, both of them are gone now, but they haven't been gone that long. And the comparative lawyers, they point that out, that simidification. He said, I'm not God. Hitler would have never said he was God. He would have lost all of his power. They wouldn't have allowed it. And there are other men in the earth that say that they're equivalent to the God or have been given all the power of God. And but it's the same thing, and God says, I'm not going to stand for it. Why? Well, it's that fundamental doctrine. The Bible says it this way, there is no mediator, no middleman, no mediator between man and God. None. There's no extra one. There's just one, the Bible says, and that is Jesus Christ. It says it just that way. Well, either that's true or it's false, but I know this. No self-respecting American would ever allow another mere man to insert himself as another middleman between him and his God. Whether he call himself a preacher, a pope, a bishop, a bureaucrat, whatever he calls himself, that's wrong. And God's not going to brook that point of view, and there'd be a horrible price paid. Jesus Christ said, call no man father. Call no man papa. That's what pope means, papa. Don't do that. Amazingly, people do it and claim to be Christian. Well, that's the long answer to the short question. I'm not sure exactly. I tried to say, well, how can I hit the nail on the head with this one? But your question seemed to be more just, what does this mean, simidification, and how do we see it? Did I come close? I hope I did.
Close enough, sir. It's an honor to talk to you. Thank you very much. I yield.
Well, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Terry. Okay, let's take our next caller, Jeremiah from California. Go right ahead. Jeremiah from California, you got the mic.
Hey, thanks a lot, John. Thank you. Hi, Brent.
Hi.
I hope I can come back on for a question, you know, in the latter portion of the show. But
sure.
I was just listening, of course, to you know, what you guys were talking about. First, I want to address the habeas corpus proceeding thing. If it's okay, I'd like to backtrack for a sec and say, well, you know, from what I've read, habeas corpus has been turned into like a statutory remedy. It, because of the fact that you know, the common law has, you know, has been statutized, if you will, right alongside with regulations and codes. So it's really difficult to find the habeas, the remedy, because statutes, right, can contain, you know, common law remedies as well as other types of law remedies. So this is case law. This is from 1943, Cal App 2 District, right? In habeas corpus proceeding to obtain release from custody after commitment for contempt, petitioner cannot be discharged from custody if the facts showing jurisdiction appear on the record. Since writ of habeas corpus cannot be used as a basis for review as upon appeal. And that is from Ex parte Hadley 135 P2D 381. And so, just putting that out there, I mean, yeah, I believe that the reason for this case law is refers to what you mentioned earlier on the call, Brent, about the process, common law being a process, and that we're losing the foresight, and, you know, I don't know what's, you know, I think that we're waking up. You know, but I guess my question is regarding habeas corpus, is it a statutory remedy and it's still common law at the same time?
Well, yeah, I'm glad you asked that. It gives me an opportunity to make note of things that are largely misunderstood, and if I could get some of these points across, it's good for us all. Our common law is not a list of laws. It is a way of life, and it's a way of life that governs all of government, including legislators and courts and the executive branch of government. Habeas corpus, as an example, habeas corpus is a creature of legislation. John, you still there?
Yep, I'm here.
Oh, I'm hearing a lot of racket, and I'm
just going to mute myself out right now. I apologize.
Oh, I thought I lost everybody. Okay.
Yeah,
I'll just keep talking then. But habeas corpus is a statutory remedy. It was from the very beginning. Parliament came up with it, and they put it into legislation. It was, before that time, unknown. And before that time, and Magna Carta makes mention of this and makes much about it and guarantees it, the common law principle is you're not supposed to, the common law principle is that jailing people, confining people to a boundary, as our common law says today, is false imprisonment. And false imprisonment is against the law. And never forget, habeas corpus doesn't just apply to the government. It applies to anybody who's falsely imprisoning somebody. And there are cases on the books where hospitals wouldn't release people, and habeas corpus petitions were filed to get them out of hospitals, out of insane asylums, out of any power, the jailing power, as our common law cases put it. So it doesn't just apply to government. And false imprisonment, wrongful imprisonment, unlawful imprisonment is against the law at common law for this reason, the most fundamental reason, because the covenants of God, most fundamentally, from the book of Genesis, say, our father, Grandpa Adam, and Grandma Eve, God told them and then repeated it to Grandpa Noah after he emerged from the ark and repeated it again to David. He said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the land. Fill the land. That means you have to have freedom of bodily locomotion to get up and go where you want to go when the impulse hits you. That's why God gives you those impulses. When Abraham was in the light of the Chaldeans, that false light of the city, Ur means light in old Semitic speech. When he was there, he had the urge to get up and get out, and he didn't even know where he was going, but he knew God wanted him to go, or he was supposed to go. For whatever reason, God somehow impelled him to leave. How much of that he understood, I don't know, but he said, I'm going, and he didn't know where he was going, but he was looking for a land. Well, at Babylon, they, of course, tried to get everybody to congregate in one place and not spread out upon the face of the land so they could control them with the law of the city, a Nimrod at that point. And God smote them with different speech. He said, I'm not going to allow that. You've got to spread out. Well, false imprisonment, you see, hampers and mitigates against the covenant of God, the basic covenant, to fill out and spread the land, spread abroad on the land. That is why it's against the law of common law most fundamentally, and that's, we can trace that back through history. But habeas corpus, but before that, false imprisonment, and you see it in Magna Carta, the method they used, every three months, every quarter, justices were sent throughout the land of England to go to every gaol, G-A-O-L, we say today, jail, and to examine every prisoner's jailing to see that it was lawful. And if they found that anybody was in a jail anywhere and the jailer couldn't prove up the lawfulness of the jailing, the man was released on the spot. Well, that wasn't working so well after a while, and the justices weren't doing their job, and probably there were bribes going on, and powerful parties had a way of keeping people in jail by paying justices off. I don't know all the details, but the background to Magna Carta explains some of that, and you can find that. Well, finally, Parliament said, we got to have another piece of machinery in place in government to allow this to go easier. So we're gonna pass legislation, and we'll claim there's a writ now, a new writ, and it's called the writ of habeas corpus. Habeas corpus means, in short, we have the body. We have the body, and that's short for we have the body, and you've got to bring the body in front of the judge. That's really what it means. It's a writ. A writ is, at common law, the word writ means a writing in a writing that is a command, or a command in writing from a greater to a lesser authority. And so the writ of habeas corpus, if it issues, it issues from a judge to a jailing power, a jailer, someone who is jailing somebody. And in doing so, then the jailer is ordered to bring the body.
Right. I need to interject here, because the judge has a duty to uphold the law of the state or the law of the case, depending on what that law, you know, what the petitioner determines. I'm on the phone. Excuse me. I'm talking. Thank you. Listen,
well,
I'm sorry about that.
Case,
but what I'm saying is that that would mean that the judge has to have an oath in order to instruct anybody about what the statutes are, you know. And habeas corpus very well may be statute. I've actually seen the statute. There is a United States Code, a statutory for habeas corpus. I think it's in the 2300s, if I'm not mistaken. But that would be interesting to find out there.
Well,
I kind of lost my train of thought because somebody was interrupting me. I apologize for that.
But habeas corpus, we don't need a statute for it because it's our Constitution has put it in writing. But remember, habeas corpus in the United States Constitution applies only to the federal courts. It doesn't apply to the state courts in California. And in California, they're free to do what they want. And there's nothing in our Constitution that says California even has to have a habeas corpus, although California is a common law jurisdiction. Therefore, it does have habeas corpus. And there's the point I wanted to make. Maybe I went too far afield trying to explain it. But the point I wanted to get at was that the legislature of every state, not the Congress of the United States, has a duty to do everything they do according to the course of the common law, and to not pass anything in law that is not in does not undergird and enforce the common law tradition, because our Constitution of the United States is a brief of common law government, and anything the legislature does that's against the common law is not law at all. You know, it's odd, though, and I know that's the standard, but I've seen where legislators, I just read recently that the legislature of Utah has done away with the common law. Well, if they've done away with the common law, trial by jury no longer exists in Utah, but that's not true. So they're just talking, not understanding. The legislatures are passing laws, putting into words things they don't even comprehend. The Supreme Court, they don't have a clue what they're saying. The Supreme Court of the United States in Erie versus Tompkins, one of those famous cases that says the common law doesn't apply to the federal courts. Well, if the common law doesn't apply to the federal courts, trial by jury is not part of a federal courts either, because trial by jury is a creature of our common law. It doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. No, they say they've got it in other parts of the world, but they don't. They mitigate it and water it down to where it doesn't mean anything. But California has habeas corpus, but the legislature then tries to adjust it and make it worthwhile and say, well, you can't retry your case with habeas corpus. Well, that's true. It's not if you're tried in a court of law and the jury says that's it, well, that common law doctrine is, that's the final say on the matter, and that ends it. And so if you can't go into court and re-argue your case. The judges are not going to let you do that. And you read a statute from California that says that. Well, that makes sense according to our common law. You're convicted. The case is closed, and that means that your jailing is lawful. But it is possible that a person is jailed and given a sentence that's too long or put under conditions that are unlawful, cruel, and unusual punishment. That's part of our common law, too. You're not allowed to jail a person in conditions that are cruel and unusual. Federal judge in California, the Ninth Circuit, within the last few years, he said that you've got to let a third of the prisoners out of the jails in California by a certain date because that's cruel and unusual. That's unlawful imprisonment. You got to stop it. Well, they never did. They just kept putting it off. I don't know what the state of that situation is. But there are a lot of things that happen in law and that are not constitutional. That means they're not according to the common law. But I know this. Most fundamentally, false imprisonment is against the law of God. And you won't find prisons at all in the Bible. You'll find men put into ward before trial, but not after trial. Those are important considerations. I like to talk about the fundamentals. You're talking about statutes and details of what California says. I'm not familiar with all that, but I know California is a habeas corpus state, and there are some things the legislature says that support and undergird and help us with our common law tradition. And there's nothing wrong with that. Everybody has a duty in government to follow our common law.
All right. Thanks for your question, Jeremiah. And we'll go to our final caller here, Mary from Massachusetts. So you got the mic. You got a question or a comment for Brent.
Hi, John. Hi, Brent.
Hi.
How you doing?
Brent, I really, really get a lot out of you coming here to share your time with us. But I was going back to the militia clauses, and it seems that because...
Can you get a little closer to your mic? Get closer to your mic, because you're coming in low. Go ahead.
Can you hear me better?
Not much, but
can
I'll
you get
do
any
my best.
Closer?
Go ahead.
Can you hear me better now?
I can hear good enough. Just keep trying. I'll listen. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to try to get as loud as I can, okay?
Thanks.
Okay. I was looking at, in the past, the situation that we were in, let's say in our revolution or the War of 1812, the militia clauses, we had the four militia clauses, but today we were in such a unique situation, we don't have anybody cooperating. We don't have the other three cooperating. So where does that leave us? I mean, especially when it comes to the sheriffs and everybody that we need to make this happen, where does that leave us when we
don't? Well, go ahead. Are you done? I don't want to jump in before you're done.
I'm done. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Well, that leaves us with personal responsibility. Personal responsibility. I cannot control, and neither can you nor anyone else, what the fellow sitting in the White House decides to do or what a congressman or a Supreme Court judge decides to do. But I can deal with what I'm supposed to do, and I can say no. I can say no when it comes my time to say no. If I'm serving on the jury and the law that I'm supposed to enforce or they want me to enforce, the prosecutor is arguing that I should enforce. If it isn't lawful, I have a duty to interpose myself and say no. Governors of states now have a duty to interpose themselves between the people of their respective states and the madness of the federal government and just simply say, no, I'm not participating. State attorney generals have that duty. Sheriffs locally have that duty. County council members have that duty. And pastors of churches have that duty. Elders and deacons, moms and dads have that duty. Their office is the most important office among men in our country. Moms and dads, fathers and mothers, they have a duty to say no. No, I am not participating in your madness. That's what we need to do. And as to the Second Amendment, I like to tell people what you need to do is make sure that you have a military-grade weapon if you are a member of the militia. If you are a male between the ages of about 20 and 45, it's your duty to at your own expense, maintain or obtain a military-grade weapon and some ammunition and to complete a good safety and marksmanship course. If you are a male, if you are a female, you have an option if you want to arm yourself. Under what I understand the law to be, you certainly don't have a duty. But males who are able-bodied to carry a weapon in battle have a duty, affirmative duty, to do so. And if they do so, and if we remain an armed people, then that'll go a long ways to thwart invasions. Nobody with any sense in their head would ever try to invade a country where the people are armed, and armed to the teeth as Americans still are. But we need to be more understanding of the militia clauses. The only militia clause most any American has any familiarity concerning is the Second Amendment. The other three militia clauses are not spoken of, and we have reached the point now, but that doesn't mean we can't do our duty before God, and our duty is before God. And if you do it, you'll have confidence and you'll have intelligence. You'll have the experience of understanding. You'll have knowledge just by simple obedience to simple duties God has given you. You'll have a knowledge and understanding that goes far beyond those that claim to be much smarter and more educated. A truly educated man understands the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. They are the ever-present part of his meditation, his contemplation, his rumination. He's constantly thinking about them. And if you're constantly thinking about them because you've got your mind on those things, you'll do them. And you'll have great confidence, and you'll know more, as David said, than all of his teachers. You'll know a lot. You won't be arrogant about it. You won't be puffed up with knowledge. You'll just know because you've done it. You've obeyed the fundamental duty God has given you. It's not our place to control other people. That's not part of our common law tradition. Our common law tradition is not about dominating other men. It's about serving other men. And you best serve other men when you take care of your own business. That's how you serve other men, because you can't take care of somebody else if you don't first take care and protect yourself. You take care of and protect yourself, and then you can protect others, and others will look to you for help. That's what will get us through the crisis. That will come. They always do. But one of the things we must do is not let happen completely what Justice Joseph Story of the U.S. Supreme Court said was among his greatest fears. And that is that we would, by neglect, ignore these four militia clauses. He said that was his fear, and that has pretty much happened. That was 175 years ago or so that he said that. Well, now it's happened. And this whole thing about standing armies, you know, standing armies are just an opportunity for the guy in command of standing armies to use them for his personal adventures, and that's what we see. We're sending our Army and Navy all over the world slaughtering people. And I can't, personally, I'm not the smartest man in the world, but neither am I the dumbest. And I can't see that this is what we should be doing. But I can see that Americans should be armed for defense, not for aggression to dominate other people, but for defense of their homes and their neighbors and their countrymen and their land. That's what God wants. That's what we should concentrate on, and we'll get great fulfillment from it. I really believe that. I think I've had some of that experience, and I want to have more of just simply doing the simple things God tells me to do. And one of them is to be ready to defend the jurisdiction that he has given us as Americans over this land, not to dominate people, but to defend it. He's given it to us. We're to defend it, and we're not to violate it or abuse it. We're not to defile it by breaking his Ten Commandments. That's the point of God's covenants and his land distribution to us as Americans. Well, those are my suggestions, and if we don't use our freedoms, our freedoms are our duties to do right, our responsibility, our opportunity to do right, and the Second Amendment's part of that. Don't worry about it. If enough people learn and get it in their minds, a critical mass of people, not a majority, just a critical mass, in their minds about these militia clauses, do what you can to spread the word about them. It'll get up to the people that are pulling the levers of power. It always does. I would suggest that you get a copy of this book I've written called The Militia Clauses. I can't even remember exactly the name. The Militia Clauses of the United States Constitution are our Constitution's answer to its enemies, foreign and domestic. That's the booklet. It's a little booklet, not big, but it's a brief of an explanation of those four militia clauses. You can get it at Amazon.com. Just type in my name, Brent Allen Winters, and I think it'll come up. And Militia of the Several States, here it is. Militia of the Several States, our Constitution's answer to its enemies, foreign and domestic. Get that book, and learn what you can about it. I appreciate your call.
Well, I appreciate your answer because, well, as we know, we're in a lot different situation since past history. It seems like we have a lot of different areas that are coming at us, and you know, since this whole franchise and of the states and the people that are not on board because even trying to get sheriff cooperation, none of it's easy because it seems like we're on our own here.
We always have been, but we're just coming to that realization. It's time to pick up our duty.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
And I will. I was looking forward to getting that book. Thank you, Brent.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mary. Appreciate the call. Okay. Gerard, are you ready to take the mic here? Thank you very much, Brent. And,
thank you.
Lord willing, we'll see you next week, and maybe we'll talk in between a week.
Okay, Lord willing. I look forward to it, John.
Okay. Gerard, are you ready to take the mic? It looks like you're muted. Let me unmute you.
You had me muted all this time? I didn't even know.
Well, a long time ago, you in the very beginning, you had a lot of sounds coming in from your house there, so we
I've
just
been
put the mute.
I've been screaming over here. I've been talking
no
over friends. I have no idea the show I just put on. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, it must have been great, huh? Sorry we missed it.
Everybody's
all right, anyway, we're going to go to anybody else that has now a question or a comment. Hit *6 to get into the queue. Gerard's going to pick up. I'm going to walk away for a short period of time, and then I'll be back. But you got the mic. I'm not going to hit any buttons. You need to hit the next question button for the next person. You're yelling and screaming again?
Hi. Do I sound okay?
You sound good, yes.
Fabulous. First, thank you, guys. God bless you. You are incredible. Mary from Massachusetts, please look under Committees of Safety under Massachusetts, and I am listed there. I'm Linda. Please call me. The New Hampshire meeting happens on Wednesday. It's fabulous. And Massachusetts, New Hampshire, all of our areas are coming to life. So I heard your voice, and I just wanted to put a shout out. So I apologize for taking the time of people. I don't have a question. I'm just listening, and I just want to connect. Thanks.
Thank you very much for that, Linda.
You're welcome.
Okay. It looks like we have Pamela Kilmer next. How you doing, Pamela?
Yeah, hi, fine. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. I'm just wondering how it's going with speaking at the CARES convention this month.
I sent them a letter. I sent an email telling them that we wanted to go, and I never got it. I mean, it was late. I sent it after your call, and I went to the site, contact us, and I told them it was National Liberty Alliance. And that we were willing to speak on the power and the authority of the sheriff, and I don't believe I ever received a response.
Well, since you got no response, how about trying again? I just think it's really, really important. I mean,
I would love to go. Well, it's quite a ways. Where is it? It's in
Minneapolis.
Minneapolis. So that would require one of us to get there, and at this time I couldn't do it. And I don't know if John is in a position to do that. That's the problem. But I thought, you know, if they said, come on out, then we could at least, you know, work on getting some funds to do
that.
Yeah,
I think if we had the funds to do it and they invited us, definitely I think we'd do everything we can to get out there. Or one of us would.
I mean,
that really catapult, you know, things ahead.
Yeah, well, it would have been nice to get an invite.
There was an invite. That's what they said last October.
Well, you know, I did look and see, and they had their, on the site, they had their agenda picked out. Now, I don't know. I should go back and check again and see who's on and what they did. And I haven't checked my email this week. I've been so busy. So I'll check that when we get off and make sure that they, you know, they still hadn't answered.
Oh, I know. It seems like if they're really serious about educating the sheriffs and they weren't infiltrated, you know, that they would certainly get, you know, somebody from NLA out there to speak, you know, directly to the sheriff. That would be the hugest opportunity. And, wow, I would think it was a catapult thing. I was so excited about that when I heard that last October that John was invited.
Right.
So disappointed when I kind of, forgotten, but. Sorry, I didn't mention it a few months ago.
Right.
There's something outrageous going on in Pennsylvania right now. They're making, I don't know if you, maybe Nikki might have mentioned it to you. It's just that they're passing this law to help victims of crime, but they want the restitution that are going to the victims to go to the Commonwealth. I mean, that's ludicrous. It's like, why should the state benefit by victims of crime? It doesn't make any sense. But anyway, I know I sent information to Nikki about that, so she was going to look into it.
Well, you know, the whole, their whole premise of what they're doing is making the state the injured party. Look at all the motor vehicle stuff. That's all the state collecting money for what? After being an injured party? I mean, it only stands to reason that they're going to keep overreaching and overreaching. And, of course, now you get a victim and they're going to collect a restitution and they're going to keep it. Isn't that amazing?
It's ludicrous.
I mean, the whole system is broke. You know, it's broken horribly. The fact that they think they can sell people's property and that they can keep the profits from it. You know, since when is the government in the real estate business that they can convert your deed, sell for over what was owed on taxes, and then keep the rest themselves? I mean, this is ludicrous. It's time for people to step up. And I believe, that we're actually in much better shape than we think we are, that it is all smoke and mirrors. Like Brent said, every able-bodied man should be armed. And the fact of the matter is they will never take us over. Never. There are more people armed in this country, and if it comes to that, they're not gonna prevail. They're just not. And everybody says, the cities. The cities, schmitties. There are more guns in the city than you can shake a stick at. They think they got them disarmed. Then why is there so many shootings in the city? Let them march in and find out just what kind of people they have when armed people. I mean, I'm not calling for armed revolution. I don't look forward to it. But you know what? If we all stood shoulder to shoulder, you wouldn't even have to bring your gun up. They know how many guns we have. They know. If there's one thing that this government does, it's keep statistics. And as far as, Obama, if you go into the gun stores, they got his picture and it says gun salesman of the year, because every time he opens up his mouth and moves to put more gun control in, everybody runs out and buys hundreds of thousands of guns. That guy has done more to put more guns in more people's hands than any other president since probably Washington. So I think it's all smoke and mirrors, to tell you the truth. They really have a big problem, and all we have to do is like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz, click your heels and you'll find your home. Our home has been smoke and mirrored away from us, and the only thing they have is their psyops. I believe they're in much worse shape than you think they are. They dumbed everybody down, and they have to work with a dumbed down workforce. It's affecting them. I mean, they got all kinds of fancy stuff, but they don't have enough of it to control all of us at the same time. They put good shows on, they do breads and circuses, and maybe they got a super galactic weapon, and that's nice too. But you know what? They can't hold up to the force of all the people standing shoulder to shoulder. So the minute that we stand together, they're finished. Just wake up. That's all we got to do is wake up. And it's coming. Believe me, it's coming. We're going to push the stuff in the courts and stack it in there, because they think they're going to surprise us by revealing their sins to us. And when we hear all the things that they did and they reveal to the people all the stuff that they did on with their false flags and how they financed both the war and all the other horrible stuff they did, instead of standing there and wringing our hands and biting our fingernails, we'll say, oh, yeah, well, look at what we have here right now. Look at those men that are here. Forget about these things that happened, 20, 30, 60 years ago that you're revealing. Let's take care of these evil judges and these evil people that we have right here in front of us that have victims whose souls are crying to heaven for vengeance, for justice. That's what has to happen. And that's what we, the people, can do. So I don't want to go off on a big tangent, but believe me, I believe that the only thing they have is their programming through their television. You don't want people? Turn the television off. Stop watching the news. Stop watching the election. It's all a bread and circuses thing. Whatever they're planning up there, it's not gonna help us at all. They have no intention of helping us, I don't believe. I believe that they know exactly what's going on, and it's all a show.
Yeah. Karen Goodis has a good post today showing that what she's doing to get the UN out of the United States.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
well,
I understand. Okay.
Well, I thought,
yes,
like,
Pam.
Go ahead.
I wasn't sure if you could hear me.
Yeah, there's some noise.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
But anyway, there's a really good post by Karen Hudis, what she is doing to get the UN out of the United States. So it's a really
yeah,
good
we've
point.
Been, and we, that's been a mantra for a long time. Get us out of the UN. Why aren't we out of it yet? I think we need to get out of it before they stick Obama there as the supreme master there, because I think that's I've heard rumors that.
Yeah, she wants to get the UN troops, but she wants to get the UN troops out of the United States.
Well, how about getting the whole UN out of the United States? Why does it have to be in our New York City?
Yeah, well, that's even better. Yeah.
Yeah, right. I mean, look at, you know, and who funds it? We fund most of it. We're paying for our own demise. We're so foolish, you know.
Right.
So people have to wake up, and I believe they are. I believe that the internet has been a big boon to us. And I heard something the other day, just a point of interest here. They said, look, at Congress has had a real hard time. The legislators in Congress want to control the internet, but the trouble is. By the time they get a bill to the floor and they vote on it and they pass it, there's something called, I believe it's Parenteau's Law. When it first came out, way back when computer chips were first being brought out, it said that computing power would double every 18 months. And guess what? It has. It's never failed not to double every 18 months since 1950 or 60 or whenever they came out with them. So what happens is by the time Congress gets a law passed, whatever it is they're trying to control is old technology. And whatever they voted on, it don't work anymore. Isn't that wonderful? You know, they can't keep up with the thing that you know, they helped create. They helped create the thing that's going to probably be their demise, because it's the only place that you can get information, you know, where you can actually find some truth. Now, I know there's lots of lies, but look at, give me both. Give me everything, and I'll separate the cockle, you know, from the fruit. You know? You know, when you turn on Fox and CNBC and all this stuff, you know, and they're up there spouting their lies, the next day there isn't somebody going over there, Dan Rather, you're full of crap because this, this, and that. That doesn't happen on network TV. It happens on the internet, though. So, you know, and they'll get up there and they'll say, oh, there's a lot of misinformation on the internet. Well, there's also a lot of information, and most of the misinformation is on the TV. So they need to be corrected. And so that's what we're up against. And look, I don't get my news off of the TV at all. I don't even watch it. Every now and then, I whatever's on the internet, I'll go through MSN and see what kind of baloney they're peddling for about 2 seconds. You know, before I go off into the areas that I'm going to, and everybody should have alternative medias that they subscribe to or that they can check with, and just keep themselves educated. And you know, look at the money has to go back to a commodity-based money, gold and silver, and that's right. That's what's happening now. Everybody knows that the Federal Reserve note is nothing. It's no good. The promissory note is dead. Oh, it's going to be alive in this country for a while because people will accept it here, but it's not going to be accepted outside our borders. And it's going to die a swift death once everybody realizes that it's no good. You know, and we're going to have to do stuff between ourselves in our communities, in our counties and in our towns. Look at we're perfectly capable of using alternative money, and I encourage everybody on this call and to encourage their friends to start getting off of that promissory note, that worthless paper. Start dealing in gold and silver and barter rice and beans, whatever, hour for hour. There's alternative money out there right now that's in use in certain areas. And the more we do that, the quicker and the easier this monetary reset will be, the softer the landing will be, you know. And the more independent our communities are, the softer it will be. And, you know, look, we have a lot of farmland in this country. And all those farm communities, you know, and we're not even using all of it. You know, they give us this baloney that we're overpopulated, we're over this. You ever drive across the country and see all that open land? And look, we have technology. We have intensive, you know, gardening, hydroponics. You can grow vegetables on roofs. You can have fish in the bottom and vegetables on the top feeding each other. I mean, we have technology to feed ourselves from now till the cows come home. And it's all a lie. We're not going to, you know, and people have done it. War-torn countries have survived by putting in hydroponic gardens on their roofs. That's how they ate. That's how they fed themselves. And sprouts, alfalfa sprouts, bean sprouts, you can do them in your window. And they have more protein than beef does. And guess what? We'll get skinny. We won't be fat anymore. We won't be obese Americans. We're going to get lean and mean. We're going to be eating alfalfa sprouts and running around like racehorses. That's what's going to happen.
Sounds good.
I'll stop now.
Thank you so much.
I'm sorry. I get carried away.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
You're welcome, Pamela, and thanks for calling, and we certainly love to hear from you. God bless you. You've certainly done your part of the battle. I know you have.
every day I work at this. Every day I'm working on something with fighting the corruption, whatever I can.
Look at, hopefully your case is going to be one of the ones that's going to be sticking there that we're going to point to and say, okay, forget all that stuff you're revealing to us, because we know what you did, and we're not going to stand here in awe and shock and dismay and you know, and anger and all those other things that happen, you know, when somebody close to you dies. It's going to be the same thing. That's what they're hoping for, those effects. No, let's take care of this stuff. Look at what you've done to Pamela. Look what you've done to this one. And we have names and dates and places. Guess what? We have no excuse not to take care of it anymore. Right now, let's get it out there. Let's shout it out, because those are the look at these guys. Once it becomes common knowledge, they're going to run. They're not even going to close their suitcases. They're going to have their pajamas dragging from the ill closed suitcase. Believe me, picture it. The guy in the back row, in the black robe, running up the road with half the stuff falling out of his suitcase. That's my vision. They're going to run like rats from a sinking ship. And it's coming.
They need to be stopped because they're still hurting other people. They just continue hurting and destroying other people's lives.
And yes, it's just like when you have a disease in your body. Before it gets better, there's a climax. And it either you either beat it, you cure it, or it kills you. Well, right now, with the dollar going down and the money not being there, and they're not going to get their funding that they used to have, they're going to get vicious for a while. They're going to try to feed off the people. And this is the time that we need to stand firm, because they are going to look at they're going through their debt thoroughs, and it's like a seven-headed hydra. You cut one head off and there's another one still flopping. We're just going to have to keep swinging until we get each head cut off. And believe me, they will get cut off, because right now I believe they're scratching at the eyeball of God. You know what happens when somebody scratches at your eyeball? It's called a reflex. God help them. Anyway, thank you, Pamela. I'm going to move on. I don't want to take up too much time.
Okay. Well, thank you, Gerard.
You're welcome. Yeah.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Robert from Illinois.
Yes, I have a question, and I want to be sensitive in how I ask it, because I want to be an agent of healing and not separation. So I'm just wondering, is there anything that we need to know as the members of NLA in regard to the strategies that we're moving forward? I guess there was some rumors about a U.S. Marshal threatening us and so on. Is there anything that we need to know? And I know some people have pulled away, you know, in different aspects. So I'm just asking you to speak your mind. I think I've given you enough to go with whichever direction you want to go, Gerard.
Okay, thanks a lot. Very,
all right.
Very delicately done. Thank you.
Hopefully, yes, thank you.
Yeah, well, I can get myself in trouble really quick by myself. But, yeah.
Well, I didn't want to hang anyone, you know, but I wanted to give you the chance to speak to it.
Yeah, and there was stuff that said, and I'm going to address basically what I heard was said anyway, and I'm assuming that this is what you're talking about. You know, when we sent people around to inquire about what they did with our paperwork,
right?
And the remark was something to the effect that, well, what are you going to do? Well, we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. We're going to put this in the court. And he said, well, he said, if you threaten the court, we will come out and arrest you.
There
if you
go.
Threaten the court, what the heck does that mean? You know what? We should be screaming that from the rooftops. Look at that shows that he's working for a corporation. It's not even they're trying to protect the judge. You know, the judges are doing a lot of evil. And if they didn't think they had enough protection, they wouldn't show up for work the next day. So they got to make them believe that they're pretty secure in their little world, and they're banging their gavel and they're making money on the backs of the people. You know, everybody that gets sent to jail, the longer the sentence is, the more money he gets in his retirement account, which is the most ridiculous thing. The average person doesn't know that. That's one of the things that we need to be putting out there. But they don't have an oath to the Constitution anymore, or at least they don't acknowledge that. If he said we're gonna go after you and arrest you for threatening the court, well, what is a threat to the court? So when you know I've been accused of being a paper terrorist in my locality here, and oh, he's a paper terrorist. Well, what the heck's a paper terrorist? I told the guy that told me that because they have fusion centers where they try to bring all the agencies together and identify, you know, the quote unquote. You know, terrorist people that believe in the Constitution and people that believe in the Bill of Rights and stuff, you know, we're terrorists now. And I said, look, do you know what a paper terrorist is? And the guy says, no, I really don't know. I said, you go back and tell him that what Gerard said, the definition of a paper terrorist, is somebody who files constitutional paperwork that they can't answer and it terrorizes them. That's what a paper terrorist is.
Mm-hmm.
That we're bringing up fundamental principles that you can't answer, and you're terrorized by it. I said, and you tell him there's nothing we're afraid of except maybe a lit match. So, you know, that's the answer we need to give to them, because he was arrogant. And, you know, let him explain himself. He sounds like a fool. If you threaten the court, well, you know, I had a congressman that signing that we helped get into office, and then because he was a Fulbright colonel before that, and we kind of helped him get in, carried his petition when we were doing the committee men stuff, and he really got in through a grassroots effort. The party didn't want him in, but you know, a lot of times they're not so opposed to a military man, because they know that military men have a certain code and that they have a certain hook in them that they can control. So they're more apt to let somebody who's been in the military into a position as Congress, because they can pull that rank thing on them. There's a certain amount of obedience they have, and they do this false obedience. You know, you're not supposed to have blind obedience. If you get an order that's against the Constitution, you're obligated not to obey it. You're obligated to disobey it. And then that is obedience. It's obedience to the Constitution. So when he signed the NDAA, I put a paper out and I said, look it. I said, you signed that thing, and that was treason as far as the people are concerned. And I said, I don't know if you did it with full knowledge of what it was. I know what they told them. They told them they appealed to his military stature, and they said, oh, if you don't sign this, our troops in Afghanistan won't get a paycheck. I mean, for somebody of his knowledge and stature to believe that kind of baloney, that's ridiculous, you know. But the fact of the matter, I said, look, either you're a toddler driving the car and you don't belong behind the wheel, or you're a homicidal maniac. And I said, so all that remains to be decided now is, do we send you home with your tail between your legs, or do we build a gallows out back and hang you? And I said, and don't say that I'm threatening terrorism on you, because all I'm doing is quoting to you the penalty of the law that you broke. Oh, they were so upset. That was terrorist speech. But you know what? That's the way I talk. And maybe they don't like it, but we need more people talking like that. You know, and the next year, guess what? He didn't vote for it. So it had an effect, didn't it?
Well, and thank you for that explanation. I guess just more practically, a lot of us are facing real life situations. I just spent 15 days in the Cook County Jail for the matter where I think you remember I talked about the judge committed fraud. He changed the date when I went in on a pretrial, and he trial date and made that the date, you know, the pretrial. Mm-hmm. Now is the trial date. Yeah, he committed fraud on the court, official misconduct, a lot of stuff. And basically, they painted me in a corner, didn't allow me to quote any Supreme Court precedents, couldn't quote any law, any definitions of words, nothing. Other states, what they do, nothing. He said, we don't care. We will take you to jail at the end of this thing. And he prejudiced the jury over and over, and I spent 15 days. I never had my habeas corpus yet. That would have been helpful, but I do want to now go back and countersue in the federal court where I can use all of those precedents and all those things. But it would be good to have that habeas in my hand when I go in. Where are we with that? I think the coordinator, we may have a change of coordinators or something. Is that in the works or what's going on?
Well, I don't know what's going on with the coordinators and that. And, you know, look at, you know, you never get justice from the state courts. And what we're finding out is we're not getting justice from the federal courts because they're not following the Constitution.
The
really
jury.
Not.
I think having a jury is my ace in the hole.
If they don't snake around it, you know, and not only that, what jury are you going to get? I mean, if you look like you have a good case, you're gonna get a tainted jury. I mean, if the prosecutor's picking the jury, it's like forget about it. See, we the people need to be the ones that run this stuff, and that's the problem. You know the best thing that we can do is get them off of their funding. Look at the dollar's going down anyway. We need to have lawful money, and in that vacuum of the dollar going down, they're done, and it's coming very shortly. You know, so right. You know, as the currency resets, we got to be ready to do to be the people that we're supposed to be. And get ready for that, because there will be a vacuum, and we need to step into that vacuum, you know?
Right. Well, I got a spark of hope when John said earlier something about we might be able to get through a few of these first habeas corpuses. Is that, I guess that's where I'm going.
The thing is, look, you can file habeas corpuses, but they're going to go in and they're going to sit there. They're not going to honor them, until such time that there's a pressure and this vacuum I'm talking about, you know, happens.
Well, if I can read it to the jury, if I have it in my hand, they can sit down all they want, and I'm walking in with it.
Listen,
and,
the judge has total control. That's the problem. You need to open a court of record. You need to fire the judge. You need to be able to educate him. And he's not, I don't know. If, you know,
I went to jail for the court of record. Remember that?
Exactly. So now you're going to go up and try it in the federal court? You know,
well,
what I mean?
not a court of record. I was just going to read the habeas to the jury, and I think I'll have a right to do that.
Right. And I don't know, you know, what's going to happen. Now, every now and then we get a jury that has a conscience because, look, when you're in court, it's a show. You know, you might as well figure you're on television. And the guy with the best show can win, only if there's a jury. You're certainly not going to win if the judge is going to make a decision on it, you know?
Right.
So that's a problem. That's a big problem. You know, how do we, the people? Now, you know, it's up to, you know, one thing, people can be pressuring their governors right now to bring the lawful Constitution back in, to give us our lawful deeds, because they think they're giving us warranty deeds and they own our property, and that's why they're able to tax it away from us. And you know your first piece of property is your body, and they don't even want us to own that because they want to tell us what we can put in it. They want to have forced vaccinations. Look, if you don't even own your own body, what else can you do? And if you can't own a piece of property, if you do own your body, where do you exercise its freedom? If you don't have a piece of property that you can call your own to exercise your freedom and to scratch out a living and do whatever else you need to do or just escape from the world, you're not free, you know? And so it's a state of mind. And right now, our governors have been resisting putting in the reset money, because this money is ready, you know, there's gold money that's ready to come in. And
right.
And what's happened is this Federal Reserve dollar, the ones that have been printing it, the ones that have been pushing it, they're telling them that don't take the gold dollar, we'll protect you. Because look, they're afraid. Every one of them has reached and dipped into this money and done things. You know, technically, if you wanted to go after them for their crimes, you wouldn't have one governor, one judge, or anybody left. You'd have to shut the whole system down. You know what I mean? They're all corrupt. And so what has to happen is they have to understand that, well, nobody's going to go after them for the sins of the past, except for the lives that they ruined. I'm talking about the funny money they took. Look, it wasn't real money anyway, was it? I mean, that's how you're going to, that's how we're going to give mercy. We're gonna forget those crimes. Do the right thing here, and the people will appreciate you helping to end this system by putting the right money in and accepting that gold money. You know what I mean? Forget this Federal Reserve note. Let it die. You know, the too big to fail banks, they should have failed back then, and we wouldn't be in this situation now. We'd be picking up the pieces, and we would all be working, because those banks wouldn't be out there controlling us and buying up everything. And you know, look, they did horrible things. They created businesses for people to work at in order to give them mortgages, full well knowing that they were going to pull the rug out from under those businesses. Those were shell businesses that were created to fail just so that they could give mortgages to people and bundle them up and sell them to Russia and China. It's a wonder that we haven't had World War III. Look at what they did to them. They gave them all this toxic debt and sold it to them. First, we sold them the idea of capitalism, told them how much money they were going to make. And they bit the apple, and they were like, oh, let's go, let's do it. And then they found out that it was poison. It was a poison apple. And so then they said, don't worry about it. We'll back it with our resources. That's what this land grab is all about. They're scrambling right now to back the promises that they made and the bad debt that they sold these countries. And these countries are not stupid. Russia's not stupid. China's not stupid. Brazil's not stupid. They understand the value. It's game over. It's been 100 years, and the people are finally awake. It's time to get rid of the funny money. It's time to go with the real money. And that's going to fix a lot of stuff. You know,
I agree with all of that. I think just to maybe rein it back in to focus on the one thing I need to know is I'm facing a real battle, and I need to know, will I have a chance
to get that
habeas corpus and walk in with it? Will I have that chance? That's what we all want to know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You can walk in with a habeas corpus. We can do a habeas corpus. I don't know what, you know, that they're going to
listen. I'm on the next tier. I'm waiting for it to be mailed. I'm at that point, and I'm just asking, is there a chance I'll get it soon?
Well, I don't know where you are with it, and John's trying to finish up the ones that he has.
Okay.
People have done habeas corpuses from the court of record type thing. I mean, with the common law grand jury, we grant them, though. You know what I mean? If you do it yourself, you have to grant it yourself. And they may laugh at that. And they're laughing at us. So I don't know. Look, you can go in with it and you can read it. And if you do it right and they actually let you talk, you might pull something off, you know.
But I got to have it to do that, so that's all I'm asking.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, you got to be careful. That's all I'm telling you. You're going to go in and read it, and they may look at, what are you going to do when the judge holds you in contempt? You know.
Well, they have to warn you first, but I have to have it first before I get to that point.
Right.
And that's what I'm asking. Will I have it?
Well, I don't know where you are on the queue.
I've completed everything. I'm waiting for it to be mailed. will mm-hmm. I have it? That's all I'm asking. Can somebody look at it and say, hey, Robert in Illinois, he needs his habeas. Can we get this out? You know what I'm saying? So,
right.
You know, I'm coming, you know, I'm being direct on this point. It's just because it's really my, you know, my question, and it's what I need to know.
Well,
I've got hearings okay. coming up.
Right, and I can't answer that because I'm not in that in
okay.
that particular thing. I
all
mean,
right, well, hopefully somebody who is, he's hearing
right.
hearing my,
I don't know,
my plea.
Yeah, and I don't know, you know, where that's, you know, going to go as far as what we're doing because, you know, look at, what are you going to do if they turn around and they say, anybody filing a habeas corpus, we're going to call terrorists.
That hasn't happened yet.
It hasn't happened yet, and the thing is look at, we should be having call outs. You should be calling your governor. You should even before you go into court, the fact that all the horrible stuff they did to you, you know, mm-hmm. our biggest results was the court watchers calling and embarrassing them.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. We got them doing affidavits on that, but I'm just
right.
hoping
and
to get
I
that.
Think that's, I think that's very powerful. I think affidavits
yeah.
going in because those are people's stories. Those are the things
yep.
that are making a record, you know, mm-hmm. You know, they won't want to file it in your case. I mean, look at, you're taking your case from the state court to the federal court. So
right.
you're pushing that number through. They should file it, but they haven't been. So I don't know, you know, you say you're going to go into the court with it, but they refuse to put it on the record. So you're going to have to carry your own in. You won't be able to go in there and get anything that we send in because they're sticking them someplace. They're not sticking them on the record.
Right.
You know what I mean?
But if I have a copy of what
right.
you file and yours sits, I can walk mine in.
Right.
Same copy. You know, same
right.
thing. That's all I'm asking.
Right. Well, so, look,
I don't want to dominate, but I just needed to get an answer to that.
Yeah, well,
and it
look,
sounds like
don't,
you don't know, but
I don't know, and I don't want to promise you something that I can't deliver to you.
Okay.
And I'm just I'm warning you, you know, not to put so much hope in it that it's going to actually do something. However, you know, I can't speak for a jury. If they let you get in front of it, and the judge isn't so stupid to where he's going to want you, going to allow you to do it, you know?
Yeah. Right. Well, I want every opportunity, every chance, you know. And
right.
If
right.
If I have it, then I can maybe use it.
Well, it's nice.
If I don't have it, it's over.
Right. And the other thing is look at, you go in with a habeas corpus. If you could go in with 20 people, the judge is going to say, you can't represent yourself. You can't read that. He's going to say a lot of stuff that you got to be prepared for. And the thing is the more people you have there putting it on the record, that's what they don't like. They don't like
okay.
their stuff, you know, being documented that they did these things. Because the
okay.
day of reckoning is coming, whether it comes for you that day or it comes for him later on. It's going to come because it's going to be on the record, you know.
Awesome. Yes, sir.
So.
Okay, Gerard. Thank you so much. I appreciate
yeah.
the time. The extra
okay.
time you gave me. All right.
Okay. Thanks,
have
Robert. Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Let's see. Next question. There's no name here. Last number is 0058. You've been unmuted.
Hi, it's Karen Hudis.
Hey, how you doing, Karen?
I'm good.
Can you turn your mic up a little or get closer to it? You sound kind of low.
How's that? Is that better?
That's much better. So how you doing, Karen? What's up tonight?
Well, what's up is that we're talking about failed currency, and there's something that we can do before it fails, and that's to exchange it, and that's what I'm calling in about, to see if there's any way we can get some support so that'll happen. Because what you were saying, Gerard, about being armed, if we can't feed ourselves because there's no way to buy any food, then we're not going to be able to, it's a pipe dream what you're talking about.
What I told people was to go to alternative currency now, gold, silver, barter, right now. It's in effect in many communities, in local communities. And if they wean themselves right now off of that note, that promissory note, it's going to make things much easier for the transition if we're not dependent on that right
with
now.
With all due respect, Gerard, we have the currency. We have the gold. And the only reason that we're not getting it is because people are not informed to ask for it, and that's what I'm the purpose of my calling in.
Okay, so they should ask who? The governors to put it in, to allow it to come in? Who's holding it back right now? The governors?
Okay. What John F. Kennedy was doing is we have the gold. It's in the World Bank and IMF.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a big trust, and I'm the overseer mandate trustee for that trust.
Right.
And what I need is I need for the National Liberty Alliance to educate its people so that we can access that. That's what I'm calling in for.
Right. So they, in other words, you need a cry out to the powers that be. The people need to demand real money, is what you're
saying.
Well,
no, I'm just trying to make it very, very plain and very simple. And before I can do that, people have to understand where we are right now. And where we are right now is that our Constitution is not in effect, and because we've got this World Bank and IMF, they have declared the United States in interregnum now. And I've been dealing with the adjutant generals, which are the National Guard. And what I just did today was I requested the UN to get any foreign troops out of the United States. And I also requested that I could see the accounts of this trust. So we're not that far from being able to switch our currency, but people have got to know where we are, and they have got to make it clear that that's what has to happen, because the Federal Reserve note is not constitutional. Our Constitution is not in effect. And if people are very clear about where we are and where we need to go, we can get there before the Federal Reserve note crashes. If the Federal Reserve note crashes before we have exchanged our currency for dollars, treasury dollars, backed by the gold that belongs to the United States, then we're into World War III. And,
right.
And the fact that we're armed is not going to help us. Those UN troops that I was talking about, it's going to be a battleground, a bloody battleground, and the chance that we do it peacefully is 90 to 95%. But we have to do it now, right now.
Mhm. Mhm. So when you say right now, that's what, in the next 2 months? I mean, is it ready to go? Is the money ready to go into the states? I mean, how can we help facilitate that?
All right, that's a good question. And Ronald Reagan printed Treasury dollars, and they are in a bank account in Switzerland. And
mm-hmm.
we're supposed to have them out, but I don't think we're going to have them out. And so what I want is for the National Guard to allow us to print the Treasury dollars from our Bureau of Printing and Engraving in Texas. And so that's the next thing that people should be asking for, demanding. It's our right to have constitutional currency and to
mm-hmm.
replace the Federal Reserve notes right now before we go down the tube.
Right, right. So that would be the soft landing that you're talking about, is getting rid of the Federal Reserve note and going to the real money.
Right.
So
the Treasury dollar would be there on an interim basis, and then we would mint the gold, and that would replace the Treasury dollar. But we need, and the fact, here's the thing. If people know that there's a group in the United States that's savvy and is asking for the Federal Reserve notes to be exchanged and that the Federal Reserve notes are unconstitutional, this is going to reassure the countries that are holding the Federal Reserve notes, because they're not going to crash if they know that we're going to be taking care of business, that we're a viable ongoing country. That's the point. If we're seen to be hoodwinked and that the citizenry is completely dumbfounded, then we're just there to be railroaded into a panic and a crash. Whereas mm-hmm. people know that we're entitled to the Treasury dollars, and that the Treasury dollars are getting exchanged for the federal for the gold. You see, it's kind of like a virtuous cycle. If we prevent this downward spiral out of control by demanding what it is that we're entitled to, then that's going to keep us strong. And the fact that we're armed is good, but we don't need to be armed if we're going to have a peaceful exchange of currency. And we should be able to get this done.
Right. So, look, I thought that the governors have to invite this money into their state. Can people call their governors and say, look, we know that there's money available. Why haven't you signed on to that?
Right, but the governors don't have to invite into it. What they have to do is they have to make sure that we can print the Treasury dollars the plant is in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
They have to make it clear that we're a viable country, that our citizens know that we're entitled to constitutional currency, and that we should be printing it right now before to replace the Federal Reserve note.
Right. Well, you know, if people really knew the way things are supposed to be, they would understand that we should have gold and silver as currency and not a fiat dollar. That's a fundamental principle of this country that we haven't followed. And like you said, you know, they're not the Constitution is basically not in effect because they're not following any of it, right? So it's up to we the people to demand those things. And you heard it here. And so it's time to go out into the streets with that and say, look, give us our real money. Let's go.
Well, I think going out in the streets is probably a dangerous place to go because of the...
Well, I'm using it as a figure of speech, you know what I mean? When I say out in the streets, I mean talking amongst ourselves. You know, look, you can still go out in a diner and talk. I'm on the grocery line, I talk. I find very few people that disagree with me anymore. You know, they used to look at me like I had three heads. But I say something, and I bring up things like this, and they're shaking their head yes. So everybody should try that. We should be talking amongst ourselves, educating ourselves to these things. You can't look at if you don't know what's going on, you can't really participate, can you? And so I think education is a very important step here that people need to understand. What this is about and what real money is about. And you know, of course, there's those forces that don't like it because they love having an unlimited supply of digital money in the sky that they can keep increasing all the time. And this would give us this real money would give us the stability so that we wouldn't have the inflation and we would be getting more of a value, you know. I'm just worried about the fact that we've allowed so much industry to leave this country. You know, we don't make a nut or a bolt over here anymore. It's ridiculous. You know, look at how many people we could employ if we could get had real money. These businesses would come back to our shores. You know, instead of exporting all this stuff and using, China to produce stuff with slave labor and send it back here. At a rate that Americans can't compete with, and that's a problem. And I think with the real money, it would put value back into our labor, you know, and we'd be able to produce things here on our own shores and export things. So look at, you know, we have a lot of people that follow us and listen to us, and so that's, you know, that's part of the start of the mantra of getting this thing going. It's by, like you said, letting the people talk about it, letting them understand that there is an answer and that we need to do that now because we can't wait for them. And you know, that's part of the plan is if they can get all, you know, the dollar to fail, then, you know, you bring the bottom up and the top down. That's the plan. We can't let that happen. We have to have that money in here and we have to be working with it. And local currency is an answer locally, especially I think there's going to be a period of adjustment where you're going to need to do some stuff on a local basis, which, you know, people should be thinking about that now. I do barter now all the time, and I have some people that I deal with, you know, that are willing to do things in real money, you know. And I think the more that we encourage people to do that, to get them in that idea of real money and the real value, you know. I mean, really, things haven't really risen in price. It's just that the money has gone down in value, you know. And I think it was Ron Paul that used to make the comparison to what a gallon of gas is really worth. And he said, look at, if we had real money, it would be 30 cents a gallon in silver, that $3. And that's what people have to realize. You know, when gas is $3 a gallon, if we had real money, it would be 30 cents. It would be 3 silver dimes for a gallon. Wouldn't that be nice? So that's the reset that we have to go through, right, Karen? Bringing it back to that point.
Well, our time is not infinite, and the Federal Reserve note is on life support. So I'm asking for some concrete support here.
Well, look, at you've reached out to a lot of people, and you know. That's how you get support. You get the word out, and so the word is out, and I've certainly been following it, you know, and that National Liberty Alliance is all for real gold and silver. Absolutely, that's what our Constitution calls for, and if there's that's our mantra, to bring that 1789 Constitution back into effect. That's what we want. I think that's what every one of us wants. That's what we always said. You know, let's bring back the 1789 Constitution. Let's bring back real money. And so that you have that support here. I don't think there's any members that would not want real gold and real silver in their money. I can't imagine it, you know. So you do have that support on those things. I mean, whatever we got to do to bring real money back in, that is the answer. You know what I mean? And that is the answer to a bloodless change, you know, a painless change. If we can just get to it now. And I think you'll find out that there's a whole lot more gold and silver in this country than you even know, because I think there have been more knowledgeable people collecting that stuff. And when the transition comes, it's going to go quickly. I mean, we have examples in other nations. People right away, they knew the value of a gold ring. They got their scales out and they learned how much a gram of gold was and what it looked like and what it was worth. So I think people, you know, we have an affinity for that, and I think that it won't go as bad as hard as people think it will. You know, I think there's enough people out there that do understand. So look, as far as I'm concerned, if we can get gold and silver money back in, the sooner the better. Because I know one thing, this Federal Reserve note I'm holding on to is getting very thin and thread-worn. The packages I'm buying with it are getting smaller and smaller. That's the other thing they do. They cut down the size. You know, that's your inflation. The inflation is that our packages are deflating. So we need to get back to real money so we can keep our packages from deflating here. So, yes, Karen, I think in that respect you do have support. I can't imagine why anybody would not support bringing that money. Look at Reagan got shot for it. Kennedy got shot for it. I mean, how stupid can we be? Obviously, it's the answer. And apparently they were ahead of their times. There weren't enough people that really realized what was going on to support it, and these guys paid for it with their lives. If they were willing to get up there and do this stuff, I mean, look at Kennedy's speech. He knew what he was up to against that monolithic power. You know, that powerful speech he gave. It hasn't changed. If anything, it's gotten worse. What he saw when he was up there, And Reagan also. Reagan had money ready to go, right?
Yeah, he printed it. I think we have to we have to get moving.
Yes.
On our trillion dollars.
Look at whatever we can do as far as that goes. That's what we want to do. We want to move in that direction because that is the right direction to go. So we're watching you. We're watching what you're doing. And I'm depending on you to tell us, as far as the barometer, you're up there where you know with your power transition model, which is gauging how this thing is going, right? And so you're kind of the mind canary here for that. So tonight you're coming here saying we don't have a lot of time, we got to get moving. So how do we get it moving? You know, you said okay, we should print it here in Texas from the mint in Texas. And that's what the people have to be saying to even their politicians. Come on, facilitate the money coming in, the gold, the silver. Let's stop it.
Right.
So I think that you do have support, and I think that you know bringing gold and silver back into the country is an answer, and it actually can help heal things. You know, I mean, we can't have this money that has no. You know, that we're paying interest on stuff that's not even there. You know, you stop the printing presses and say, okay, pay your bills. There's not enough money in existence to pay the debt that's out there. It's ridiculous. It's a lie. It's smoke and mirrors. So we have to get rid of that smoke and mirrors. You know, it really is the Wizard of Oz. We really need to click our heels together and clear out the smoke and bring in the gold and silver. And I don't know what else I can say, Karen, but, you know, that's the best I can tell you. I mean, it's my mantra, and hopefully people understand that, you know, this is the direction we need to go. And we've averted World War III a couple of times here in the past 2 years. People don't realize how close we've come to World War III. And we got these other countries that don't want it. They're tired of war. They want real money, you know. And you know, it's all in place now. And we don't want to go with this New World Order money, whatever they have. The special drawing rights is no good. I don't know if people understand that the special drawing rights is where they'll lock us down into more of this the same craziness. And so, anyway, I thank you. I want to move on before you give some other people a chance. Thank you for coming on, Karen. And we look forward to... What's that?
Thanks for having me.
Yes, and we're looking forward for more reports, you know, as far as what, you know, letting us know where we are in the reset. You know, if that stuff's coming in, we want to know what we need to do and how close we are. That way, people can know what to expect. Thank you, Karen.
Right.
Okay. Next question is Kansas Jan. You've been unmuted.
Okay. Thank you. I am changing my question since Karen was on. Thank you, Karen. Appreciate hearing from you. She said I don't know how to ask this question. She said that she asked that the foreign troops be removed from our country.
Yes. Well, okay. She asked that the UN take them out, but she is working with the National Guard. That was one thing I was going to ask her. How do we get the foreign troops out? How do you get the UN to obey such a request? And I think the answer is that our National Guard should facilitate that. I don't particularly know, you know, if she has an answer to that. Matter of fact, I just unmuted her. Karen, feel free to answer that. I mean, I know you said you asked them to remove the foreign troops. Who's gonna enforce that, or what is it that's gonna make them obey such an order?
Well, I copied the adjutant general for Maryland, and I said that I was speaking on behalf of the National Guard, and so she could have always contradicted me and said, no, I had no right to commit the National Guard. So that's how I did it.
Okay, so it's kind of like my. You're right. It's like it's as powerful what they don't say as what they do say. So in other words, she didn't say that you couldn't use the National Guard. So they kind of have an order now.
Yeah,
right?
I said I was speaking on behalf of the National Guard.
Right, and when she didn't come back and say you can't speak on their behalf, then that means that she agrees with you.
Well, I kind of boxed them in. Can you imagine how the National Guard is going to say, yes, you can keep your troops here?
Right. Well, that's, again, I think the answer is that the people have to wake up and demand it, require it. That's the difference. If everybody knows we have foreign troops here, you say, hey, what do we have foreign troops here for? What are you planning anyway?
Yeah.
You know? That's the whole thing. So...
Who said they could come here anyway? Who let them in? Who asked them to come in? Or didn't just invade us, did they? Or did somebody invite them?
Well, our government invited them. They're doing joint forces all the time. They did Jade Helm. They're pulling all this baloney all the time because.
Okay, and is that for? Excuse me, Gerard. Is that for the purpose that it appears that they want to overtake our nation?
Well, I have my opinions of why they did it exactly, because they know that American troops are not going to for very long try to hold Americans down. It's not going to happen. If you're gonna pull something over here, you're not going to use Americans against Americans. I don't believe that. I mean, maybe in small areas, you know, certain stupid SWAT teams of guys that are all. Jacked up on steroids that feel like going out, but even those guys will lose a stomach for it. They got families too over here, you know.
Yeah.
This is their motherland. I mean, at some point they're going to say this is crazy. Even the crazies are going to say this is crazy. Look, if they don't have foreign troops over here, they're not going to pull it off. So I think that's almost as important as bringing the money in is getting those troops out. So any time we see them, we should protest, and we should be protesting to our governors, because that's who invites them in, by the way. Jade Helm, they needed the permission of the governor to bring them in, ultimately.
Yeah. Well, that was my final question, and I'll get off so that somebody else can talk. But are the troops, in your opinion, or Karen's, if she could, felt like she could comment, but Gerard, do you feel that is tied together, that the troops are here to protect the Federal Reserve note in some way? I mean, is that how it all ties together?
Well, that's probably a good point. I mean, no, we haven't said that, but absolutely. How are you gonna force that on the people? You know what I mean? So we can't allow any kind of martial law or anything like that, and I don't think it'll happen if the people don't riot. They won't have an excuse to. How are they going to put
martial law?
I understand that, but you know, look, we're not under curfew and all that other baloney. I understand that they believe that we're in martial law because it's been perpetuated since the Civil War that they have us under this martial law. I don't subscribe to it. I don't believe that holds any water, except for, look, we are. But every time a police officer pulls you over and does. And stops you. That's kind of a martial law thing right there, is it not?
Yeah. Is that what Karen? I missed it. Is that what Karen just said, that we are under martial law?
Oh yeah, because we have they declared martial law way back in 18. What is it?
Yeah.
In 1870 something, right? And every president has extended it since then.
Okay.
What's up with that? I mean, you know. I mean, the average person should know that we're under martial law, and they should complain, and they should say, what's this business where you're signing that we're under martial law? I mean, to me, that's treason right there. When a president signs that we're under martial law, how are we under martial law? You know, have we been vanquished by some other country? Martial law is when you take over a country that you're fighting with, you put martial law in when you're establishing a new government. They have no right to declare under martial law.
Did Reagan sign that too, and Kennedy?
Well, you know what? That's a good question. I don't particularly know that. I bet you they did because they probably didn't know any better.
Okay.
I mean, not that I'm making an excuse for them, but, you know, I think every president has signed it because I think if they didn't sign it, the courts would close. I think these are admiralty courts under martial law, and that's how they sleep at night because they've told themselves, you know, that, oh, well, you know, these people, they're, you know, they're contracting into this and we're under martial law. Look, they always like to make laws to justify themselves because I think it helps shut their conscience off at night because they got this thing on a piece of paper.
And so that's how then they circumvent the Constitution. They put it kind of on hold and just say, well, they don't tell us that we're not under the Constitution. They let us believe, deceitfully believe, that we are still under the Constitution, but they know we're under this admiralty or martial law type thing.
Well, yeah, and they're not so sneaky about it anymore. They're kind of coming out and saying it more and more. Look, we went to court with the New York State Attorney General, and when we were there, we did a common law paper. He said, "You won't get any common law here." I mean, what? In other words, we don't get any Constitution there, is what he's saying. And judges tell people, "This is not about the Constitution." Well, it's all about the Constitution because if you're not following that contract, what are you following?
Yeah. Well,
we're following, you know, the LIBOR code, the martial law code, you know what I mean? So people have to realize what this is about, and it only has power because we allow it.
Yes.
You know, and that's another thing that the governor should be hearing from everybody. You know?
Mm-hmm.
It should be a campaign issue. You're welcome.
Thank you, George. Thank you, Kieran.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to go to the next caller who is, looks like Elvia. You've been unmuted. Can you hear me? Elvia, 0603, you're unmuted.
Maybe hi, Gerard.
Hi, Elvia.
Thank you for unmuting me. I still don't understand how or what we can do to exchange the fiat money that we have for lawful money. It's just not clear to me whether or not this is something that's available to us. Who would even make it available to the people?
Well, it's already available because the money, the gold is coming in. But I mean, look, you can exchange Federal Reserve notes for gold and silver. But Karen's talking about something bigger than that. Look, you should be taking some of those Federal Reserve
notes. 1 minute.
And you should be turning them into, you know, a commodity-based money, which is gold and silver. Everybody can do that. You can buy a little bit each week, but the money, the gold that they stole from us is now sitting there in an account, and what they're gonna do is print this money with gold threads in it. It's gonna be actual gold, but not right away. The first thing that has to happen is those treasury notes, which are backed by the gold, are going to have to come in. There's going to have to be a phase out, and so during that phase out, you may have to barter. You may have to look at. You want to be dealing. You want to get some of this gold and silver on your own. That's what's going to make the soft landing. Is people are prepared with real money, and look at. You know, you should have some stores of food and stuff where you can go where you don't have to run to the store every day. They have us relegated to this thing where we're just-in-time shipping. People don't buy enough groceries for a week. They were so used to stopping at the store and getting everything, you know?
But, Gerard, the thing is, if I do, let's just say that I do exchange the fiat money for silver dollars. How am I going to use that to buy anything at the store? They're going to look at me like I'm insane. I'll be using a silver dollar that's really worth, what, 25 of the dollars of the Federal Reserve note?
No, and then what
am I going to get back?
First of all, if you shop local farmers and stuff, and you come approach them and say, look, I have silver. It's worth whatever the spot price. You need to keep track of the spot price when you're dealing in gold and silver. People will learn real fast in local communities. There's money called, what do you call it? Alternative money right now in different states that they're using. Now, it works in their communities because everybody accepts it. Now, look, gold and silver is readily acceptable for many, many people right now. You go in and you talk to a merchant, you say, look, I got this, it's worth this many Federal Reserve notes, and this is what I want to deal in. This is up to you to get to the people in your community and get them used to accepting this. And they will,
awesome.
Because it's look at, you know, maybe the guy at the gas station, if he's an independent operator, he'll let you buy a gallon of gas for 3 silver dimes. That's what you want to get to, because he's going to understand that Federal Reserve note, you know what it's worth? It's not worth 3 cents. That's what you got to tell him.
Right.
And that's
okay.
And if once you explain that, he'd be look at, if you came to me and you told me you were going to give me silver dollars for working on your car, guess what? I'd scoff them right up.
Okay.
So there are people that understand this out there. More and more people understand this.
Fred, we've come over our time. If you want to
okay,
just finalize.
Okay, thank you. So anyway,
by the way, a gallon of gas is 1 silver dime. But go ahead, Elvia.
Oh, I'm
thank
sorry.
Thank you so much. That's
even better.
I don't think that the U.S. mint prints or issues dimes or anything less than a quarter, do they?
No, there's lots of what's called junk silver out there. There's lots and lots of dimes, lots and lots of quarters, half dollars, and silver dollars is a little tough, but because a lot of people are really hoarding onto those and holding them, and they're a little more expensive, but they're available. Silver's plenty available right now. Anybody who's not saving in silver is not thinking. If you can save, a couple of dollars a month, do it in silver and put it in go get yourself a little safe and put it in your safe.
And yes, you can buy dimes and quarters and all of that right now. Like you said, they call it junk silver.
Okay, with that we've come to the end of our program.
Okay,
and
thank
my last
you.
Question, my last question, Gerard, I've been meaning to ask this. Actually, I've sent this question in, and I've never been able to get the answer. Sometime last year, I think in October of 2015, you mentioned that there was a time when you had a conversation with a judge in New York about when they switched from common law to not common law, and I think that there was a vote, and the majority of vote
I did answer that on a call. I don't know if you were on it, but I did answer it, and I think the case was Hughes versus Hayes, and it was a split of New York. This was a New York court ruling, Supreme Court. It wasn't a federal court ruling, and it was like 5-3. But the three judges that wrote the dissenting opinion, they actually called it treason. They called it unconstitutional. And what we did is we wrote back and said, we're the people, and we agree with these three judges, and we don't care what your other four judges said, and you're all in dishonor, and you're all in treason. You know what I mean?
What was the case again?
I think it was Hughes versus Hayes, and it was Judge Prudente that sent us the paper. After that, they stopped talking to us. They didn't want to answer us anymore.
But how do you spell the name Hughes?
I think H-U, oh, you're asking.
I think it was H-U-G-E-S.
Right, Hughes versus Hayes, H-A-Y-E-S or H-A-Y-S. I can find it for you because I think.
Thank you so much. Do you know what year that was?
I do not know. I can, but we did have it. We did have it on the site at one point. I don't know if it's still there. The Prudente. It's old stuff. It was way back in the beginning when we first started NLA, when we were going into the courts and they were trying to keep us out.
Yeah, we were back, and then we were New York committeemen, possibly heading over into New York Liberty Alliance, and then eventually National Liberty Alliance.
Yeah, we weren't going into the courts as New York committeemen, Yard. We were going into the courts
well,
as
after,
the Commonwealth.
At that point, when we were battling them, at that point we were as the New York
and that's
New York Liberty Alliance.
There was no common law, and I mean, I think I have it. I think I can find it, and maybe I can send it to you, Elvia. Okay.
Thank you so much, Yard. I appreciate that.
Okay. Okay.
All right.
So we really got to go.
End our evening. So
yeah.
Thank you much for the call. All right. Thanks, everyone, for coming. And Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. And please don't forget to join us on Thursday evening for organizing at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time right here in the same room. And organizing the nation and getting things moving on the grassroots level. Thank you.
Good night.